so. Well, we've got one of my new favorite guests coming on the program tonight. Athanasios Komianos is going to join us to talk about, well, his book, Rapid Entity Attachment Release, is his book that he wants to talk about. So that is going to give us, I think, a very, very interesting conversation all the night through about spirit attachments. Now, if there's one thing that I know about Athanasios Komianos is that he is very thorough in the research that he does, and, well, he just thinks about things and looks about things a little differently than what we're used to. So I think tonight will be an incredibly interesting look at the spirit attachment phenomenon and how he has obviously figured out how to take care of this if he's got a book titled Rapid Entity Attachment Release. In fact, the word that catches me there is rapid, because, gosh, you know, I've watched a few movies here recently about exorcisms. I've been watching that show Paranormal Survivor, and a lot of different programs about those kind of things. And normally, if you have a real spirit attachment, and I mean the real thing, not just maybe a cup fell over in your house or maybe you feel like you're being watched, I mean when you're dealing with the real thing, it's not so easy to take care of. Many times people will try to get rid of a particular spirit, maybe even a demon if it gets that bad. And it can sometimes take many, many tries. Sometimes these things can go on and on and on for months, sometimes years. I've heard of people having to have repeated exorcisms again and again and again and again. So when I see a title like Rapid Entity Attachment Release, well, that gets my attention. And of course, you know, the last time Athanasios Komianos was on the program, we were talking about, well, the fascinating book, Chronicles from the Future. And that was incredibly interesting. So I, you know, I'm venturing to bet tonight isn't going to be much different from that. He's an incredible guest, and I'm looking forward to him showing up on the program. So I wonder, I've got a bunch of news here to talk about, but I just wonder if you all would indulge me in a little brief ghost update. I had not intended on talking about him tonight, but I think I saw something that is a good indicator for the future here. So, of course, one of the things you know I'm worried about is how are the two cats going to get along? Are they ever going to get along? Are we going to have a fight situation? You know, what's going to happen? Well, so as I normally do, you know, I'm in the kitchen. I had to grab a bite before the program tonight, and I was in there sort of rummaging around the kitchen. And Layla, one of the things, weird things that we do is if I'm rummaging in the kitchen, well, anything I have in my hand, she wants to check it out. I guess this is just a weird thing that we do. So here comes Ghost out of his room. He's hanging out in the living room. And here comes Layla in the kitchen to do what we usually do in the kitchen. Anytime I grab something off a shelf or out of a cabinet or anything, she wants to see what it is too. So I had grabbed something out of the freezer and she wanted to see what it was. So I showed it to her. And then all of a sudden, here comes Ghost. He wants to see it too. He's meowing. He could see from where he was. He could see what we were doing. So here he comes, and you could see Layla just change for a second, and she didn't know what was about to happen. And he's meowing as he's coming closer to her, kind of like, yeah, I want to see that too. Whatever you're looking at over there, I want to see. I want to be a part of it. So here he comes, and she just sits down, and I'm thinking, okay, you know, this is between them. I can't get in the middle of this. So I kind of back away a little bit and just observe to see what is about to happen, something good or something bad. And it was the most adorable thing. I, you know, a lot of you who have multiple cats have probably seen this, but I have never seen this in my own house. So Layla sits there, just sits on her little butt, waiting for him to walk up to her. And she's growling, you know, the way cats do. She's growling, but she isn't moving. And so while she's sitting there growling, Ghost walked right up to her and put his little nose right on her nose. And they stayed like that for just a little split second. And she didn't do anything. She didn't try to fight him. nothing. And it doesn't seem like much, but I thought it was a very good step. If she'll let him do that, maybe there's hope, huh? Maybe there is hope. Now, Friday, we had all done a bit of a mass consciousness experiment to let Ghost know he doesn't have to be afraid. And I bet you're probably wondering, well, did it work? Did it work at all? Did we have any success with that at all? Well, the other thing I was going to do is sleep in his room. And at first, you know, nothing happened. I'd wake up in there and he was not around. So then, well, the second or the third night, I think, when I woke up in there, sleeping in there, well, he got out and he was waking me up. He was meowing at me. Hey, wake up. I'm hungry. Go get me something. So that's a good sign. Another good sign is ever since last Friday and the mass consciousness experiment that we did for him, he seems to be just all over the house. I'm catching him all over the house more and more often. And I just give him his freedom. You know, I do keep a distance from him so he can just explore the house and do what he wants to do. But I'm seeing him now exploring all over the house much, much more than he did before, which is a great thing. Also, I wondered, you know, his lip is quite injured still. And it is healing. Although last week it didn't look so good, so I got him some L-lysine. Supposed to help kitty cats and their immune system, to help them to heal better. So I've been giving him that as well. So I think between the medicine, the mass consciousness experiment that we did, and me kind of keeping my distance from him, I mean, we play. I do get him to play more and more often, which is great. I think there just might be some hope here. I think these two kitties may end up getting along. I sure hope so. And if you were wondering just how he's doing, I think the L-lysine is really helping him out. He seems to be chipper. He seems to be in a great little mood, if you can possibly tell what kind of mood he's in. But he seems very, very playful. So this is a good sign, and that's how he's doing. So on to a bunch of news that we have to talk about before Athanasios Komianos joins the program. After the bottom of the hour break, he'll be joining us to talk about spirit attachments. Boy, did we ever have a scare last night. As soon as I get done with the program, I kind of like to check the news just to see, is there anything major going on? And, well, there was. At 12:30, actually 12:31 a.m. Pacific time, local time in the Gulf of Alaska, actually, there was a 7.9 earthquake. Whew. Now, that is a big number on the Richter scale. Well, there's a little bit of debate, 7.9, 8.2. I say, you know, anytime you're around the 8.0 on the Richter scale area, yeah, let's just pretty much say the ground is shaking. Well, the danger of an earthquake in that particular area is tsunami, a very big danger. Well, after the earthquake was reported, like I said, at 12:31 a.m. local time in the Gulf of Alaska, according to the United States Geological Survey, there was no immediate reports of damage or fatalities, but the United States National Tsunami Warning Center said that a small tsunami with a wave height of less than 8 inches had been observed in a handful of Alaskan cities, including Kodiak and Seward. Well, what's a big deal? It's an 8-inch wave. Right? What is the big deal? Well, let me see. It was only 7 years ago that Japan was shaken by a 9.0 earthquake, the strongest earthquake ever recorded in Japan. And that earthquake set off a powerful tsunami that breached the sea walls of the coastal towns, killing at least 15,000 people and sparking the Fukushima crisis that is still ongoing, by the way. There was a 9.1 earthquake. One of the most powerful earthquakes ever recorded struck off the Indonesian island of Sumatra in December 2004, generating enormous waves that killed more than 230,000 people, mostly in Indonesia, but also in India, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and even as far away as Somalia. word, tsunami. Yes, I panic, even if it's only an 8-inch wave. You know, that number right there, 230,000 people losing their lives. Let's face it. Can any of us really grasp what that number means? It's almost too big of a number. So I really had a big scare. You know, I know quite a few people along up the coastline there, the West Coast coastline, on up into Alaska. And I didn't know what was going to happen. And then as I'm waiting, biting my nails to see what was going to happen, is there going to be a tsunami? Is everybody okay? How much damage did the earthquake do? All of a sudden, well, the tsunami warning is called off. So what happened? Why was there no tsunami? Don't get me wrong. I am very thankful that there was no tsunami. Thank goodness. I mean, what with the missile scare in Hawaii, and now with this, is 2018 going to be the year of the near miss? Well, the earthquake occurred about 175 miles southeast Kodiak Island, and the region is part of a large subduction zone where one large piece of the Earth's surface, in this case the floor of the Pacific Ocean, is slowly sliding under another piece of the Earth's surface, the North American continent. And the Alaska subduction zone is a source of a lot of earthquakes, including one in 1964 that, well, magnitude 9.2, just about the largest earthquake ever recorded. Well, Peter House, oh my gosh, look at his name. Peter, this is just a difficult name to pronounce here. Hausler? Okay, I think it's Hausler. He is a research geologist with the United States Geological Survey in Anchorage, and he said that the 7.9 earthquake just last night did not occur directly where those two subduction plates meet. Rather, it appeared that this earthquake took place at a point where the Pacific Ocean floor plate bends and starts to slide under the North American continent. So the direction of the fault movement in this case was horizontal, more like the San Andreas Fault in California. And it would be a lot less likely to generate a large tsunami. So I just call this, we got lucky. We got very, very lucky here of where the earthquake took place and the fault line that it took place on. And I'm very, very thankful for that. With all the natural disasters that happened last year, you know, I just thought January is a little too soon for another one. Although, you know, there are no guarantees in these areas. But speaking of natural phenomena, we've got something very interesting coming up for us on Wednesday. And so, have you heard about this? Have you heard about the lunar eclipse that's about to happen on Wednesday? Early Wednesday morning, this is going to take place. And it's not just a normal lunar eclipse. This is going to be quite a special once-in-a-lifetime lunar eclipse. So we got to kind of run down our little list here. So there's a phenomenon called the blue moon, and that's when you've got a second full moon in a month with two full moons. Then, of course, there's the lunar eclipse, and that happens when the moon is obscured, when it passes directly behind the Earth into the Earth's shadow. There's also the supermoon phenomenon. That's when the full moon is the closest it can get to Earth along the moon's elliptical orbit, resulting in a slightly larger than usual appearance of the moon. There's also the phenomenon of the blood moon, and this is a reddish supermoon caused when the Earth's atmosphere refracts green to violet, giving the moon a red tinge. So this coming Wednesday, coming here before we know it, on January 31st, we are going to have a super blue blood moon. Yeah, try saying that one five times fast. Super blue blood moon. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be absolutely beautiful. But if you're on the East Coast, well, you might not get the full show. If you're on the West Coast of the United States, well, you are absolutely in luck. And this is what I wanted to talk about, is I wanted to let everybody know when this will take place and what you might see. So on this coming Wednesday morning before sunrise, the super blue blood moon will be visible in North America, Alaska, and Hawaii. Boy, can you imagine looking at this from the islands of Hawaii? Anyhow, those who are in the Middle East, Asia, Eastern Russia, Australia, and New Zealand will see the super blue blood moon during moonrise in the morning. And this is according to NASA. And specifically, now, sky watchers on the west coast of the United States will see the lunar eclipse begin at 3:48 a.m. Pacific time. Now, this is not good for me. Here I am trying to catch up on my sleep and be a responsible adult. Now we're going to have a lunar eclipse starting at 3:48 a.m. Wednesday morning. Well, let me see here now. Totality is going to start at around 4:51 a.m. Pacific time, and it'll last until 5 minutes past 6 a.m. And viewers in the area will experience the lunar eclipse from start to finish, just as long as you don't have cloud cover. That's the only problem there. So if you're on the West Coast, you're certainly in luck. If you're on the East Coast, well, you're going to have to either get up very early in the morning or stay up very late at night in order to see it. Because, let me see, the eclipse is going to begin on the East Coast at 5:51 a.m. Eastern Time. And the problem is that, well, let me see here, about a half an hour after that, the sun is going to start coming up and you won't see the show. So, let me see here now. And the moon is expected to enter only the outer part of the Earth's shadow at 5:51 a.m. Eastern Time. And it's not until 6:48 a.m. Eastern Time that the darker part of the Earth's shadow will start to blanket the moon and cause the blood red tint of the blood moon. And the moon will set just less than a half an hour later. So whether you see this eclipse or not, Wednesday, January 31st, is going to be a powerful day for new beginnings and gratitude. An eclipse is always a wonderful, powerful time to think about all the things in your life that you're already grateful for. And new moons and full moons are always about new beginnings. And if there's a new beginning that you want in your life, well, January 31st would be a really good day to meditate on that or focus on that. And you'd be surprised what can happen when you start, well, coinciding with the cycles of the moon. It's a really interesting thing that you have to experience. It's a real difficult thing to explain, actually. And I'm looking at a headline here that it's hard to believe is actually real. And the headline is this: scientists warn bizarre zombie disease could soon appear in humans. I'm not kidding. I can't believe I was looking at this. In fact, this was one of the articles I was going to talk about last night, although we missed out on the opportunity last night due to technical difficulties that are now straightened out. So, throughout the past decade, many types of bird and swine flu have managed to jump from animals to humans, causing deadly outbreaks in some parts of the world. Well, now scientists in North America are growing increasingly concerned about the risk of a bizarre zombie disease. I did not add the word bizarre. That's in the article, actually. That is being transmitted to humans through the consumption of infected animals' meat. And this is actually, all jokes aside, this is why I wanted to talk about this. It's a little news and a little public service announcement. And by the way, thank you to Brett Tingley for this report. So authorities from Colorado to Missouri have been detecting evidence of a widespread outbreak of chronic wasting disease, or they call it CWD, in deer across the United States. Now, the disease attacks the brain through the introduction of prions, a type of highly infectious misfolded protein. Now, I don't know what misfolded protein is. It sounds bad. That's all I can tell you. Well, misfolded proteins apparently cause nearby proteins in brain tissue to misfold as well. And this causes all kinds of neurological damage, eventually leading to a zombie-like state in which animals walk repetitive set patterns. They avoid other animals and generally become listless and catatonic until brain function ceases altogether. Fortunately, it doesn't turn them into, you know, rabid killing machines seeking your brains. But while the disease has so far been confined to deer, elk, and caribou, there are signs that it is adapting to spread to new areas of the animal kingdom, possibly even to us. And again, this is why I wanted to talk about it, because Canadian researchers have discovered that chronic wasting disease can spread to primates who eat infected deer meat. And now, American scientists are worried that the popularity of deer meat, also known as venison, in many rural areas means chronic wasting disease might soon turn, well, those unsuspecting venison eaters into zombies. Matt Dunphy is the head of the Chronic Wasting Disease Alliance in Colorado, says that while humans have so far been comforted by the fact that a species barrier has prevented the spread of this zombie disease to humans, recent data show that the barrier might not be quite as robust as we once thought. God, I just hate it when they're vague like that. Given the deer-to-primate transmission is a relatively recent phenomenon, scientists feel that some strains of the disease, well, might be very close to jumping to humans. And I know a lot of people out there enjoy venison. You do, but I want you to be very, very careful about the venison that you eat if this is going on right now. In all seriousness, I would hate for any of my listeners out there to be patient zero with something like this. So just be careful out there. If you're a hunter and you hunt your meat, observe your animal very closely before you go ahead and put that on your dinner plate. And so here's another oddball story. I don't know whether to laugh or cry at this story. Actually, this is also on midnightinthedesert.com if you want to go and take a look at it. Four men in India were arrested for, get this, trying to sell somebody a genie in a bottle. And I'm not kidding. So the Press Trust of India reported a story that they say has global importance, that four men, including a police driver, tried to con two people into setting up a cash exchange for a wish-granting genie, only to rob the buyers of the cash that they happened to have on hand. The story goes that, the gentleman's name is Tapas. He got a call from his friend that there was a genie in a bottle somebody was selling, and they decided to tell another friend of theirs and go check it out. So the price was about 1,000,000 rupees for this genie in a bottle. That's about $15,700 American. So the meeting was arranged, and the friend went with his friend to a hotel where they were met by the four con artists. All of them got into a car with a police sticker on it. I'm not quite sure what that indicates. And the sellers, who have not been named, showed off a soda bottle and claimed that inside there was a genie. Now, come on. They couldn't even get a fancy bottle. I mean, if you're going to do it, really do it. Get a fancy bottle. Don't use a plastic soda bottle. So it kind of ends a little sad. The guy says, look, I don't actually have that kind of money. And then the four guys trying to sell the genie in the bottle, well, they just decide to rob the two friends for whatever cash they have in their pockets, which pretty much added up to about $9.42. So the guys are short $9.42. They did not get the genie in the bottle. And whoever perpetrated this crime, boy, they need to get some aesthetic going on. I mean, come on. You're going to sell somebody a genie in a bottle and you're going to use a soda bottle? This will not do. Well, we got to take us a break anyhow. And when we come back, Athanasios Komianos will join the program to talk about his book, Rapid Entity Attachment Release. I am so excited about this conversation with Nasos. Well, we'll be right back. I'm Heather Wayne. Well, it is an absolute pleasure to introduce you to my friend and new absolute favorite guest, Athanasios Komianos. Now, his friends call him Nasos when we open up the phone lines later on, way later on in the program. You are more than welcome to address him as Nasos, a whole lot easier to pronounce. Well, he was born in Kefisia, Greece, in 1964, and he moved to the United States, where he studied psychology in Rose State College at Oklahoma City. Soon, he moved from Oklahoma University and graduated from Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, in 1985 as a sociology graduate. He had to abandon his graduate work and return to Greece for family reasons. His interest in hypnosis and in-depth psychology was still with him until finally, after a very long and torturous detour, he came to practice it as a hypnotherapist on the island of Corfu, Greece. He was approved as a certified hypnotherapist by the National Guild of Hypnotists, as a certified regression therapist by the International Board for Regression Therapy, and he was a member of the IARRT. He also has served at the board of the Earth Association for Regression Therapy as vice president from 2009 to 2013 and president from 2013 to 15. Since 2013, he has moved back to Kefisia, where he is successfully running his therapeutic practice. He is also the founder and director of the Greek Academy of Regression Therapy. Now, he has published several articles on the Journal for Regression Therapy, as well as several articles on the Greek weekly magazine called Phenomena, and is the author of two books. Nasos is also very well known as a deep researcher of the paranormal and parapsychological phenomena, and has just formed a center in Athens where these phenomena are studied. It was due to his interest in what others call the metaphysical that he studied the Valley of the Roses in depth. And he was also the first person to present this story outside of Greece. I remember him because the last time he was on this program, we had one of the most fascinating conversations that ever took place on this show about the book Chronicles from the Future. Well, we're here tonight to talk about something a little bit different, spirit attachments. And it is with pleasure and it is an honor to welcome Athanasios Komianos to the program tonight. Welcome to the show. I can pronounce your name now.
Remind me to sign the certificate for this.
Is that what happens once you...
You did a great progress, I tell you, from
well,
the other time.
A lot of practice
oh, yeah.
There.
It's difficult for you. But we should remind our listeners that my name in Greek means actually immortal.
Yes, that's right. I remember this now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you shorten it...
There is a meaning. Usually in every Greek name, there is a meaning behind the name. So there is an interpretation always. So it means immortal.
Well, when we shorten your name and call you Nasos, does that...
It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything. It strips the meaning from it. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yep. Well, but it's far easier to say it, you know.
It is, until you practice, and then it becomes fun. Then you walk around the house just saying, Athanasios Komianos, I got it. If anybody saw this, me dealing with the cats and trying to practice your name, they would clearly say, this person is crazy. Don't let her around the public. Oh, my gosh.
Let me offer you a chocolate when we meet. I will... offer you a chocolate for your success.
Well, how have you been? Man, it's been a little while since the last time we talked. You been okay?
It's been months, I guess, eh?
Yeah,
it was about 6 months ago.
Yes.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doing very well.
Good. It's glad to hear it.
A cold day here today. It's 7:30 in the morning in Athens. It's about in the 30s, in 30 Fahrenheit, and it's a beautiful day.
Mm.
Wintertime.
All the way from Athens. You see, I never get over this. It never gets old to me that I can sit here where I am and talk to you halfway around the globe. It is just so cool. Well, we have business on the table, Athanasios, okay. Mr. Immortal. We have business on the table. So you wrote this book, very interesting book about spirit attachments, but I think it's jumping ahead to talk about that right away. I want to find out something that we didn't have a chance to talk about last time, which is why did you want to be a therapist? Why did you want to practice in therapy at all?
Yeah, that's a good question. From a very young age, I encountered and had experiences which some people label paranormal. And those experiences literally stigmatized my soul. So I had to find out the questions to my answers for what had happened at the time.
You mean the answers to your questions?
Yeah, answers to my questions, yes. The first experience, most of the experience took place when I was 12 years old.
Very impressionable young. Time, yes.
Yes, and the first one was at that time I was being taught French. In English, in Greece, we always have the tradition to always learn a foreign or a couple of foreign languages. Mm-hmm. It's almost mandatory. Mm-hmm. So I was studying French as well at the time, and I saw a dream. And in that dream, a friend of mine from school told me that he cannot come to the lesson of French because he was really feeling sick and he couldn't make it. So I woke up in the morning and I remembered clearly that dream. When I went to school and after the school was over, he comes in and he tells me exactly that same phrase in the same setting. Even the sun was blinding my eyes trying to see his face. So I said, "Aha, what's this? I saw that. It was in my dream, exactly the same thing." So I realized at the time it was such a shock for me. I was talking for this experience for days because I realized that the human mind can travel in time. In other words, I saw the future even if it was only 12 hours away. Mm-hmm. I was there in the future, so there must be a loop, you know, a way to go back in time or ahead in time. So that was the first experience that really shocked me. The second experience was when I was sleeping at night, and all of a sudden I stand up, and as I turn my back, I turn my head backwards, I see myself sleeping on the bed while I was up. And I was in total shock because immediately I was so afraid that I woke up, but I couldn't move myself. I was paralyzed. And that was not a hallucination. As you can understand, it was not a hallucination. It was the beginning of an out-of-body experience, as I learned afterwards.
Yes.
And so I realized that that night, even though I was in deep shock, that the soul, the spirit, can differentiate itself from the body. And as soon as I did that, then another incident happened where I had another spontaneous out-of-body experience. And there I started walking, or actually flying through the walls. The first thing I did is go into my parents' room to see what's happening. They were sleeping. And then I started moving around until I fell onto the apparition of my dead grandfather, who had died 20 days ago. It was April of 1976. I remember that like today. And his apparition was so distorted and deformed because he died of very severe diabetes. Mm. And he had to be amputated, and he had open wounds when he died.
Oh.
And the shock of seeing that apparition drove me back to my body again. And that was the end of my out-of-body experiences. Never again did I. I was very afraid to fly out of the body.
Yes.
That was the end. But what I discovered on that occasion is that the spirit doesn't die with the body. I knew that the body was buried, but some part is left behind, and probably that is what we call the spirit or the soul or the ghost, name it what you will. That that spirit and the way it looked so frightening is what shook me. And that was the beginning of a quest. Now, more than 40 years have passed till that time. But now I know. I have answered all the three questions that haunted me back then.
That is a powerful set of experiences for a 12-year-old to have. And you learned, I think, some also very powerful lessons. Number one, that, well, what you see and touch in this world is not all there is. You know, let's not overlook that. That's a profound thing to realize as a youngster. That you can dislodge from your body is an indication that there really is a soul or a spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Coming face to face with your grandfather's spirit, well, this tells you, yes, there is an afterlife. That is a very powerful set of experiences to have. This must have made you such a contemplative child. It had to have, at some degree. Did you?
But, you know, I had... I was 13 years old in 1977. I traveled to the United States, and I saw the universities there, and I was so thrilled of the beauty of the universities in America that I decided that when I finish school, I'm going to America to study. And my father was saying, "What are you talking about? We don't have the money to send you there." Well, you know, want something and it will happen.
That's right.
My aunts and relatives supported me, and there I was. It happened. So I decided to study psychology because I thought psychology is the closest science to answer such questions. That was my naive thinking of the time, that psychology will provide me with all the answers to these big questions of life. But to my dismay and disappointment, this did not happen. You know, do you know what psychology means?
I don't think I do know the exact dictionary definition.
Well, you know, they're using Greek words again. They coined that word, which means logos is the essence, and psyche is the soul. So, the reasoning of the soul, okay? So, it's understanding of the soul. But what I understood when I went into college is that psyche is absent in any of the studies about psychology. It was so evident that psychology was actually behaviorology.
Yes.
The study of human behavior.
Yes, yes.
Okay? And I was so disappointed, you know, studying about the experiments of Skinner and his pigeons is not going to provide me any answers.
No, that's not going to explain why you had a spontaneous out-of-body experience.
Exactly. And then I realized that for one reason or another, that such strange phenomena are not examined by psychologists, but by parapsychologists. So that was another disappointment. Why should this topic, these topics, be given to parapsychologists who are scorned sometimes by the mainstream scientists? It was evident that people wanted to make psychology look like natural sciences. They wanted to imitate, physics and chemistry, which are based on specific laws, and you have results and you have equations, and you have easy mathematics that you can explain everything. So it is easier to have an environment where you think you control things than to start studying what you cannot see, the transparent. So that was quite an interesting story there in America, because it was 1983 at the University of Oklahoma when they invited me to, I was only 19 years old at the time, but there were a group of Americans. You Americans have a nice thing, because when you are over with your work, or when you retire, or when you get older, you go back to school, you go back to university, and actually those are the best students, the old ones that go back to school. So at the time, there were people my age now, and they asked me to come over and see a past life regression at their house. I said, what? Past life regression? What is this? I mean, do we have past lives? No way. So I went there, and there they are in the Midwest, Oklahoma, in the middle of nowhere. A lady who has never gone out of the borders of Oklahoma. She went only to Texas, I think. And she's describing a past life in ancient Egypt, when ancient Egypt was ruled by the Greeks. After Alexander the Great, Egypt was part of the Macedonian Empire, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And she's describing that time as a man, not as a woman, and as a soldier, a warrior. And she speaks out a Greek word at the time, which was, a word that she could not have known no matter what, because even I did not know that word at the time, and I had to look it up at the ancient Greek dictionary. And it shocked me, because I couldn't explain how this lady in the middle of nowhere could tune in with such a story and come up with a foreign word she had never heard in her life, and which was a meaningful word. So that really shook me, and I went to my professors and I told them the story, and they said, what are you doing? This is not, you should not be going there. This is not for you, man. You have to stick with your studies. But tell me, you have to answer this question for me. No, they wouldn't. So then, I was really disappointed. Anyway, due to economic problems, I had to go elsewhere. I went to the Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. And I concluded my studies there in sociology. I turned into sociology. Maybe that would give me the answers. No, it didn't give me the answers. But at least through sociology studies, I realized how mean psychiatry is.
Yeah.
I discovered that, and I was fascinated by the work of Erwin Goffman. Erwin Goffman was a sociologist who entered into an asylum of psychiatric asylum, and he stayed there pretending to be a patient, and he saw how people were treated and how they were faced and how they were mistreated, actually. And he came out with a fascinating book called Asylums at the time. And when I read that, I was really shocked, because I realized, again, you know, the synthesis of psyche, the soul, and iatrio, iatros is the Greek word for doctor, medicine, okay? So, again, psychiatry is not doing what is he supposed to do. Actually, psychiatry was a way to restrain people who were borderline or out of the fringe and or on the fringe, and it was to restrain these people, to keep them away and suppress their expressions. It was actually a suppressing science. And when, you know, they couldn't use the straitjacket anymore, or they could not use electroshock therapy anymore, they turned everyone into medication. And you go there because you are a bit depressed, and they tell you, get Xanax, get Zoloft, get Valium, get Prozac. Mm-hmm. This is not a solution. So for me, psychiatry today is actually a science of prescriptionology.
Prescriptionology. Yeah, you're right about that. It is. And what disappoints me about psychiatry is that almost everything we experience, almost everything we feel from our interactions with other people in the world, can be classified as a mental illness. Almost your own personality by psychiatry can be classified as a mental illness. And certainly paranormal experiences are almost guaranteed to be looked at by psychiatry as a mental illness. And this is disappointing, especially for a man like yourself who wants to understand, you know, why do we have the experiences that we have? And the answer you're given is, well, don't worry about the experiences. Just give them the pill so that all that goes away. Well, exactly. You're not getting a look at it. When you do that, you're just covering it up. And even then, some of the pills don't exactly cover it up all that well. Why cover it up? I understand some people genuinely need medication, but
I do that too. I understand that too, of course. Yeah. Chemistry plays a role, but not solely this. I mean, these people don't want actually to solve the problem of the patient, you know? They are over, they're, you see, there is the DSM. Diagnostic Statistical Manual, and it has many versions, you know, number one, number two, number three, number four, now we are five, and each time it's revised according to the cultural norms, and it's actually very culture specific. I mean, it is, it was produced in the United States in the first place, and the United Nations has made another version of it, more liberal and more broad, let's say, but
great, just what we need, another version of the DSM. That is not something we need. Oh man, well, this is actually a very interesting topic as it relates to the paranormal, although the audience out there may be wondering what in the world. Trust me, just follow our lead on this. We are headed somewhere with this conversation. We got to take us a break already, Nassos, if you would.
Okay.
We'll pick it up from exactly right here when we come back, because I want to hear your train of thought on this. I'm very curious about that. Cool. Well, Athanasios Komianos is here tonight, and, well, we're going to work our conversation toward spirit attachments. We'll pick it up from exactly right here when we come back from the break, and I am so excited about tonight. This is going to be a fascinating conversation, and we'll be right back. You know, that really is the cool thing about having a long-form talk show. You get the time you need to really go through a subject, and the subject tonight requires that amount of time. Now, I'd like to welcome back our guest this evening, Athanasios Komianos, who's joining us all the way from Athens, Greece, which is just so cool. Now, before the break, we were talking about the DSM. Now, I'm not a big fan of the DSM for my reasons, but I want to hear about it from you.
Yes, Heather. What I was trying to say, of course, that does not mean that all psychiatrists behave that way. There are people who deviate from the norm. What I'm criticizing is the norm. And the norm is now, unfortunately, and especially in the United States, there seems to be a complex of industry, big chemical companies on the one hand, insurance companies on the other. So when a person is referring for help to the medical world in for psychiatric reasons, then in order for them to pay, people have to be classified with some disorder. So for most of it seems to us that one in two persons is bipolar. It seems that almost everyone has attention deficit disorder.
Yes.
almost everybody has post-traumatic stress disorder. So it goes on and on. It is a constant classification, which is actually behaving like a straitjacket. You know, people are filled in drawers, and they are treated as if they are constantly bipolar, or they are constantly depressed, or they are constantly in deficit disorder. And you know how many billions are spent on psychiatric medication per year? The amount is tremendous. It's impossible to think.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking, that it's probably a staggering figure.
Exactly. If you go into the World Health Organization and check the figures there, you will be shocked. You cannot count the numbers and how many pills are supplied to people. So we moved in from the very expensive service of psychoanalysis back in the beginnings of the 20th century. We have moved now to prescriptionology, as I said. So it seems that if you have an insurance company, all what is happening to you is transferred to that company, so they know what is happening to you. This is violation of your private your privacy and your how do you call that? It's infringement of your privacy. You know, because the psychiatrist has to disclose things to the insurance company to show that you are in trouble and you have a disorder. So they work that way now. That is really frightening.
Oh, it is. And God forbid you need this help. And God forbid you have anything paranormal going on in your life. You know, many times I'll tell a paranormal experience story that I find that somebody experienced online, and they write their experience down. And if the experience involves going to the doctor at all, they'll almost always 100% of the time they'll say, well, I went to go check with my doctor and I did not say a word about my experience to the doctor, because this is only going to make it worse for you. And if
so
you are classified,
they are absolutely insincere. They don't say the story, the crucial story, and they go, you know, on the side.
Yes.
This is terrible. You know how many people I see and how many people, you know, they tell me, oh, and let me share this story with you. And they lower their voice because they're afraid somebody else is going to listen to that shocking paranormal experience that they would never dare to talk with their medical doctor.
Mm.
That is terrible, and they have a great responsibility, and they don't respect what they do and the title they have. Psychiatrist, I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Do you remember Rosenhan? Rosenhan, Dr. Rosenhan?
Yeah, that name sounds familiar, but I'm afraid I don't think I know anything about the doctor.
He was a psychologist, and he was a very interesting guy because he understood that the DSM is not working correctly. In other words, if you say you hear voices, if you say you see apparitions, if you say a few things, definitely they take you and they close you in, the words. Okay, so what he did is took students of his, sophomores from his university, and he sent them out to a psychiatric clinic, and he told them, you're going to be saying these three words. So the guys walked in. They said these three words, and they were immediately taken in for a treatment, and then they behaved absolutely normal. They wouldn't let them go out. They wouldn't let them, they wouldn't release them after a few days, after a week, after so. They kept them in as they were sick. That happened back in the 70s, early 70s.
Oh, you mean they were committed?
Yes.
I see.
So finally the professor comes out and says, hey, those are my students. Let them go. They wouldn't let them go.
Oh, no.
So due to this movement by Rosenhan, psychiatry collapsed because all asylums after that had to close down because he really did a blow. And actually, you know, they said, okay, we made a mistake, the psychiatrist. And they said, now we know, send us how many students you want, and we will discover for sure if they are sick or not. So they are there waiting for the students to come in, and the people are coming in, and they say, you have this, you have that, you have this, you have that. And they come with a report that 37 students of Rosenhan are coming in. And we have them with these diseases and with these disorders. And then Rosenhan comes out and he says, I didn't send anyone. Just write down Rosenhan experiment back in the 70s. It happened there in America, you know.
Okay.
And it was a disaster for psych. It was an embarrassing state. Everybody was very upset with him. They were really pissed off for what happened at that time. But thank God. There are some people like this every now and then, like Erwin Goffman, we said a while ago, and Rosenhan and others, who are not going by the mainstream, and they see the faults. And when you see the fault, and you point it out, there is progress. You go on, you move on forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope I made my point. I dislike the traditional approach of psychiatry. And
I gather from listening to you, it almost sounds like you went into psychiatry to try to learn about the soul, to try to learn about these experiences that we have that just aren't classified, that we don't really understand.
Mm-hmm.
And then you find, well, as we say here in America, you went into psychiatry and you got...
psychology.
Psychology,
yeah.
And you got...
Don't mention, because, you know, psychiatrists have a medical education.
Right. They're the ones that...
General doctors, and then they have...
Yeah.
It's a different thing.
I think they're the ones who dole out the medication.
Yeah.
Well, you got what we call here in the United States a cold splash of water in the face. You know, you want to go into this thing and you're all gung-ho and all excited about it. And then you find, oh, no, this is not what you're looking for at all. And it seems to me, and I just want to clarify this, if I'm understanding you correctly, because this is what I think we ought to do. You know, I understand some people are genuinely crazy, but not every person who has a paranormal experience is out of their mind. And I think we should look just as carefully at the experience they have along with any other complaints that they may have, to truly understand what's going on with this person and to understand these experiences that we have. So do you think that? Do you think we should look at these experiences also instead of just pushing them off to the side?
Okay, keep on pushing off to the side, and what will happen? You are never going to evolve. You see, there is a resistance, and there is an explanation why this is happening. And the reason this is happening is because by psychology and psychiatry trying to imitate the hard sciences, so to say, they try to eliminate all these phenomena that are deviant, that are borderline. Okay, so they try to not to see them. And the problem with modern psychology is the fact that it is materialist. In other words, it does not accept the existence of the soul. It's like, you know, if I tell you, would you go to a dentist that does not believe in the existence of teeth? Would you go there?
Well, when you put it like that...
Yeah. You know. Would you go to a cardiologist who doesn't believe in the existence of the heart?
No, I would not.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Why
not.
Then go to a psychologist?
They don't live up to the name, the title, psychologist.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. I'm making a point. Mm-hmm. And not all of them, of course, I repeat that. But the majority, the vast majority, are materialists. And they don't accept the existence of the soul. Now, that's the big difference from the mainstream traditional psychotherapists and regression therapists and hypnotherapists, some of the hypnotherapists at least. They accept the existence of the soul. And not only they accept the survival of the soul after physical death, but they accept the migration of the soul from one body to another and another. And another, they accept reincarnation. So that's the big difference. Mm-hmm. So we have materialist science on the one hand, and we have Christianity on the other hand, which doesn't really allow us enough space for us to walk in between. We are smashed between the two ideologies, because Christianity accepts the existence of the soul and the survival of the death hypothesis, but does not accept the transmigration of the souls. It stops. Actually, the first Christians did accept that notion, but it was after the 6th century when in 553, Emperor Justinian created an edict where he anathematized all beliefs in the pre-existence of the soul and transmigration of the soul. So it was a political decision.
So was it the Gnostic Christians who accepted that?
Yeah, there were some Christians who accepted the transmigration of the souls, the very early Christians, and there were also the Cathars and the Bogomils and other heretics, so to say, who did not accept the official dogma of the Catholic Church at the time, or the Orthodox after the 12th century. So, you see, it's very difficult to walk between these two camps, the Christian camp and the, you know, the scientific camp, and allow yourself the acceptance of the soul, because that's what we are going to be talking about now. We are finally approaching our subject, which is what happens to the soul after death. And where does it go after death? Does it go straight to the light? Does it go to hell? Does it go to heavens? Where does it go? What does it do?
Well, and you know, I noticed that earlier in the program, when you were talking about the big questions that you had, you said, and I found the answers to all three questions. And so this I've been waiting for.
Yes. Great. So my answer, my Via Regia. Via Regia is the Latin words for the royal route. The royal route for me was hypnosis and hypnotic states. I was trained again in the Silver Method, which is actually an American
the Silver
innovation.
Method Silver of method, mind
yeah.
control?
Remember back in the 60s and 70s? And
yeah.
You are very young, but...
Well, no, I read that book, actually. I know
you remember that, blue book?
Yes.
The little book?
Yes. Huh? I used to have a copy of it, yes.
Yeah. I had an uncle in America. He's not alive anymore. He was working for the Silver Method, and he sent me the books back in 1990. And I took that little tiny black book, and I was visiting Kenya at the time in Africa. And I was stolen and robbed of all my money. They put two guns on my head, and they took everything from me. And they just gave me, they left me with two coins. So I was really disappointed. But I read in that little booklet when Silva, Jose Silva, won the lottery. If you remember, he won an exorbitant amount of money back in the 50s when he saw in the dream the number that won the sweepstake.
Mm-hmm.
And he stopped by a nearby drugstore, and he walked in, and he had told the dream to his friend, and his friend ran into the lottery ticket, and he said, "Wait a minute, is that the numbers that you saw in your dreams?" And that's how he got it. And he won, I think it was $10,000. I don't know. It was a big amount for the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So he kept on his research. Well, the same night I was robbed, I had those 20 shillings on me in Kenya. And I went to the casino because that's what we had planned for the day. And guess what?
Did you hit it? Or did you lose your two coins?
Guess what?
Okay, I'm gonna guess you
I
won.
I walked out with money for a whole year.
Really?
Yeah, I lost the money I had. It was with a significant amount of money because I just had arrived in... it was the first time I ever worked in a casino, and it was the first time I ever played the roulette. And I did not lose a single anything. I won seven consecutive times with different moves and some same moves. And everybody was shocked because they were coming from all tables to see what, you know, it was like a movie. Have you seen movies that, you know, the guy, the Sean Connery is winning and he's making money on? The same thing happened to me. And it was amazing. It was as if a superpower gave me back the money. So from there on, I knew I was on the right track. So I attended the Silver Method, and I did all the courses available at the time. And back then it was really great. And so I familiarized myself with the trance state and what you can do with your mind and how little of your mind you are actually using in your everyday life.
Mm.
So that was the seed that started back in 90, and it went on and on. And I started, kept on studying and studying until eventually I had hypnotic training and hypnotherapy training, and then training into regression therapy, which is a variant, let's say, because with regression therapy, what you are trying to do is go back to where the problem originated. You regress in time, you go back to your client, and you try to locate the origin of the problem. Where did that problem start? Where did it originate? And if you use altered state of consciousness, if you use, you know, a trance state, it is far easier to go there because, in a way, you immobilize the analytical, critical thinking that usually permeates everything we do in the Western world. So we have to get our critical thinking on the side first and then allow through trance to go into the problem. And, of course, the problem is mostly a trauma.
Usually, okay? Yes.
Usually there is a trauma there. You actually have to interview your client. You have to go through whatever has gone in their lives, all the difficult situations that may have led to dissociation, to the disintegration of personality. So you have to really see what is going through the interview. And then when you put them into trance, you ask them to bring out the story. What is the story that leads to the problem? And that's an art. That's a great art. But it takes a long time to do. That's why people don't bother, I mean therapists don't bother to do that, because then they would have very few appointments per day and sessions. I can only do two sessions a day. I cannot do more than that. Each session is three and a half hours. How could I do more than that? You know, I collapse after that. I'm dead.
Well, I'm sure.
Drained. So, but other regular, traditional, mainstream therapists are seeing 20 people a day. 25. Yeah. It is very good for their account in the bank.
Oh, it's very good for their appointment book, but I don't know how good it is for the patients. I mean, I remember going in for counseling once or twice, and I remember one particular session where I just poured my heart out to the perfect stranger. And at the end of it, she went, "Okay, well, your time is up. We'll see you next week." And I'm going, you've nothing to say? What I just told you would make a bestseller. I'm not even kidding. Like, you have nothing to say at all. Not even, hey, keep your chin up. Nothing. It was like there was just no connection, Nasos. And when you're going in for therapy, I mean, come on, the word is therapy here. And there's just no connection at all. I don't think it's possible to help another person without making a connection. So the reason you get so wore out and you can only do two appointments a day is because you are actually making a connection with these people. And
you have to identify. You have to get in their shoes, you know?
Yes, you do. You absolutely do.
You have
do.
To understand their pain and how it was. For you, maybe this is nothing to worry about. But for them, it is a mountain in front of them. You know, they have they magnify probably a tiny problem, but still you have to get in their shoes and go into their position and see with their eyes what they're going through.
Oh, you absolutely.
You cannot detach yourself. You cannot be so detached. You have to connect,
well,
as you said. That's the good word.
I think it's connect. And it's the emotional, there's an emotional investment that needs to take place. And that does cost. It costs you in the form of being a little more drained at the end of the day, as opposed to other people doing the same kind of work. There is an emotional cost there. But the reward must just be incredible. For making that connection, you probably get closer to fixing the actual problem. We'll take a break and we'll get into that when we come back from the break here. Because a night with Athanasios Komianos, boy, just flies right by. Before you know it, we'll be right back and the conversation will continue. I'm Heather Wade. Well, Athanasios Komianos is here all the way from Athens. We're discussing something really interesting right now, sort of the differences between regression therapy and traditional psychology, which when you start talking about the paranormal, there are some stark differences in the two. And I'd like to welcome Nasos on back to the show. Welcome back.
Thank you, Heather.
So, you know, you were talking about this woman earlier who you witnessed her past life regression. Now, if this woman came to you, you wouldn't call her crazy. You would help her in her regression therapy get to the core of the problem, wouldn't you?
Well, that's how we go about. We are trying to take a full interview first and understand why people refer to us in the first place. And as soon as we have a picture of what is happening in their life, then we move to the next step, which is actually to use altered states of consciousness. You see, that's the difference with traditional talk therapy. We employ in our armament, we do have the ability to produce trance and get them with one of the most impressive tools that humanity has to move into the problem. Of course, we are not doing something which is really new, you know. It used to happen back in Greece, in ancient Greece.
Yes, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, you see, back in ancient Greece, we had what we call enchymesis, which is actually what today we call hypnosis. But that time there was the practice of enchymesis or the practice of dream healing. And people would go into the Asclepia. God Asclepios was the god of medicine. And they would resort there to solve a problem. And they would follow a specific diet. They would detoxify themselves. They would engage in hydrotherapy, massage, gymnastics, theater, which were all surrounding the specific temple at the time. And after they had their interview with the doctor at the time, Dr. Priest, let's put it that way, then they would enter into the Avaton. The Avaton was the impassable place where no one can go. You know, it's a totally dark place where incubation was taking place. In other words, there was a whole series of processes that allowed these people to focus on their problem, concentrate, make sure that they are able to see that problem. And once they were sure, they would make them walk barefoot into darkness, with thousands of snakes crawling around the ground. And after they would pass these snakes, they would go into their chambers, which were totally dark. They would tie them around as if they were pharaohs, you know, like a mummy, and immobilize them, and then put them on these klines. Klines in Greek means a bed, and that is actually where the word clinic comes from. It is coming exactly from those beds that they were using at antiquity back then. So then people would be entranced because, you know, if you are in total darkness and you walk barefoot and you suddenly step on a snake, immediately you start working with your reptilian mind and brain. You get my point.
You go back to a more primitive state.
Yeah, it's like going in the safe mode in computer, let's say. Sometimes if your computer has problems, it stops working in the full mode and it works in a safe mode with far less features. Mm-hmm. It is the primitive computer there, the older one, that survives attacks and such things. And you can do some work on this. Exactly the same thing happens with the brain. It seems that cerebral, frontal cerebral shuts down for one reason or another because fear is there, and it works in a safe mode. And people then are entranced and led into incubation, and through incubation, by staying there still, they were expecting to see a dream, which was usually a dream coming from the god Asclepios. And that would have a solution to their problem, a personal solution. Let's say we have the same problem, you and I. Mm-hmm. The dreams we are going to see, though, and the solution to our problem is totally different. It's as if there is a prescription only for Nassos, a prescription only for Heather.
Mm-hmm. Now, that makes
personalized.
Sense. That makes more sense to me. We're all individuals. There is no one-size-fits-all answer that's going to help everyone across the board. I think this is another big mistake that we're making, that traditional psychology is making. We're not all the same.
Exactly. So you cannot be treated that way. It has to be prescribed personally. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that in ancient Greece, it was mainly that they used altered states of consciousness to come into therapy. And the word therapy comes from these temples of Asclepios. That's the first time we meet the word therapy in the world. So clinic comes from there, therapy comes from there, all kinds of things come from there, whatever. Mm. Even the white robes that doctors wear today comes from there.
Mm. And if those doctors saw what our doctors today are doing, they wouldn't recognize it.
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, it was not only psychological treatment. They had surgeries done there. And if you see the tools in the museums, if you ever come in Greece, they are totally identical with today's tools. Totally identical. They have nothing to share. Of course, they don't have robotics and they don't do that. They didn't know the human body as we know it today, but they were quite advanced. We think of them as they were not advanced. They were quite advanced, actually. We have to keep that in mind, and we have to respect our past before we think that we know everything today. No, we don't know shit.
Whoops, we got to watch the language on the program.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay. We don't, well, we think we have it all figured out, but we don't, because look, I go by results. Look at the results. You've got more people than ever on these kind of psychological pills, more people than ever are depressed, more people than ever experience a whole list of conditions. And what are we told? Well, we can manage it for you, but, you know, people that have your condition can still live a long and healthy and productive life, but you're going to have this forever. You know, these people don't get answers. And then on top of that, if a person thinks they're remembering a past life, or they have a problem from a past life, or say they have an experience like you had where you find yourself out of your body, mm-hmm. Well, there's no one to turn to at all to talk about something like that, even if it's not a problem. You don't have anyone to turn to even discuss these things. And I think that's a huge mistake.
Yeah, you can turn into the internet. You know, there are forums. Most people do that now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They write down their experience, and all of a sudden they discover there is a group that are talking about this experience. Or, oh, there is another group they're talking about. So they do this. And they turn into this because it's far more understanding, because these people have similar experiences and they have a forum where they can talk about it and they feel like family. So, for instance, there are a lot of people who had a near-death experience, and they have a really harsh time coming back and understanding reality again. So, it is very difficult for them to comprehend what has happened to them. So when they find this forum and start talking, they understand that they are not alone, that there are people with similar experiences out there. So I strongly suggest that if you do have such kinds of, let's say, metaphysical — I don't believe they are metaphysical, by the way. I think they are physicals. Since they happen, they are physical. Okay, they're not metaphysical. We label them that way, but it's not a proper word. They are extraordinary. Yes, I would say extraordinary. They are not that ordinary. They are exceptional. Yes, but they happen. So please refer to forums. They will help you out in case you do have such problems. And then you can always, if you still want to work on it, you can always find a qualified therapist to do your work.
Mm-hmm. It might take some looking, but I'm sure they're out there.
Oh, well, yeah, there are.
Do you think,
it takes looking, yeah, absolutely.
Do you think medical science or other fields of scientific study ought to be looking much more closer at these kind of outlying experiences, these anomalies? They probably look at these kind of experiences as anomalies or hallucinations.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are exceptional scientists right now throughout the world, but there are very few, actually, you know, that study those experiences. The survival of consciousness, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, children's who remember previous lives. A lot of this work has been going on. There are several institutes in America that do that, for instance. The best one, to my knowledge, is the University of Virginia, where they do have a department of perceptual studies, which is a fascinating place there, where they study both ESP phenomena, which means extrasensory perception phenomena, on the one hand. They study near-death experiences, on the other. They collect cases from all over the world, and also children's spontaneous memories of past lives. So, in a sense, after 58 years of this department is at work, they have gathered enough evidence to support the idea that indeed the soul exists, the physical death, and that not only it exists, but it goes on and on and on. Not only them, also at the Duke University, the Ryan Institute is also studying other parapsychological phenomena like telepathy, precognition, ESP, you know, you name it. A lot of phenomena that are belonging to the fringe or the border of consciousness. So actually, there is the Institute of Noetic Sciences in California, Northern California, I think it is. Also, they are doing a lot of work on this direction. So there are little lighthouses here and there who are doing this. Mm. And there are other minor institutes in Europe, I think in Holland and in England, and in India, you know, some small institutes that are actually studying this, though. And they have substantial evidence to support the thesis that indeed there is spiritual survival.
Well, okay. There's these light posts out there, but
oh yes,
is anyone studying what you wrote about? I mean, talk about a fringe subject. It's even, I think, fringe in the paranormal, which is spirit attachment.
Yeah,
so
that's
how,
fringe of the fringe.
Yeah, well, a little bit. So how did you get attracted to this subject? Was it an experience? Was it a person going through some? Was it something that you discovered in regression therapy?
Mm-hmm. Yes. You see, when you employ trance and hypnosis as a means to reach the problem, you have to be really open to come up with unusual phenomena. Okay, you have to be prepared that anything can happen during the session. Well, at the time, I was studying an excellent book by Shakuntala Modi. She's an Indian lady who lives in America, though. She's a medical psychiatrist, and she's somewhere in West Virginia. And she wrote an excellent book at the time, back in the 90s. It's called Remarkable Healings.
Mm.
Half of it was dedicated to hypnosis, and it was an excellent read. But when I reached there, I ran into the concept of possession. and spirit possession. And I said, what is this lady talking about? What is that? This is crazy. This is preposterous. She should be, you know, her license should be taken away.
Go back to the Middle Ages, right?
Yeah, this is nonsense. This is nothing. I refused to look at the book, but I kept something. When I, you know, I went through the pages, I looked at a few things. I was really upset. So I left the book on the side. And I have a client in Corfu at the time I was working. And she walks in and she says, I was reading out a script for producing hypnosis. And she said, can you please shut up so I can tell you what I see? She had already fallen in trance. And I said, you know, I was in shock. What? She told me to shut up. Oh, what did I do? So what's wrong with this? So I said, okay, tell me what you see. And she's flying over a cemetery, the Corfu cemetery. And actually, what she was seeing and what was happening is that her grandfather was in her body. And he was possessing her. And he was there within her aura and her body. So I said, oh my God, what is happening? I was trying to follow up the case. The case was happening that way. And I remembered that Dr. Modi had said, well, send them to the light. I said, okay, let me do that. Let me send them to the light. So I do precisely this. I talk to the grandfather and I tell him, listen, you're dead now. You have to go to the light. And there he goes to the light, and there the woman is relieved, and then she opens her eyes, and she feels totally relieved, and she's still grateful for this experience that she had. It only took us half an hour, and she became a new person because of this. But she became a new person, and I became a new person, because her experience opened up the doors. Then I ran back into the book again. I read it all to the end. And then I read all the bibliography that was on that book back in 1997.
I bet you did.
Oh, yeah.
I bet you did.
So at that time, I said, you were too harsh on her. That should not be the case. Let's start studying the phenomenon. And I realized at that time that there were hundreds of people who had run into this problem, and some of them had the courage to publish on this, and then of course they were crucified for this, or they were thrown into the fire at stake. But anyway, they had published on this, and I realized that this phenomenon is older than Jesus Christ. It goes back 2,500 years ago. It goes back to ancient Greece, ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia, Syria, ancient Syria, and we have writings about expelling spirits and the whole procedures of how these people at that time were doing it, and how they would talk to the spirits, how they would make them go out of the patient and the person who was sick, and they would become well. We have many testimonials from that era, but people did not notice them, did not really focus on them. They really had no idea what was going on. So I did this. I studied those cases from history, and in modern days, we have a fascinating account of Frederick Myers of the SPR. The Spirit, SPR was the Society of Psychical Research in England.
Mm-hmm.
And Myers and other scholars like Edmund Gurney were the creators of that society back in the 1880s, where they started studying human consciousness and the manifestations of personality and what was going on there. And we have fabulous accounts in his magnum opus, Human Personality and the Survival of Death. an excellent book that now you can find on PDF online if you want and download it for your listeners, that is, of stories of the disintegration of personality. So actually, Myers is summarizing all the work that has been done by hypnotists during the 19th century. There are about 100 people who were employing throughout Europe, in Germany, in Italy, in France, in England, in major countries. They were using hypnosis as the main tool to address the issues of the people, of their patients at the time, with remarkable results, very remarkable results. And Myers comes out with the idea that, listen, there is possession there. We do have genuine phenomena of spirit possession. People are possessed by human spirits, not demonic spirits. We may talk about that later on, but he was the first to really point out that in the 19th century. And an excellent book by Dr. Palmer has come out about spiritual attachments. And actually, he is the first PhD ever awarded on such an issue. It's called The Science of Spirit Possession.
Well, I think I'm just happy to hear that he got any kind of accolades for this sort of study. Because,
yes,
you know, as we've been saying throughout the night, usually you get into these areas and people are just going to look at you like you're crazy. And they're not going to take you seriously after that. That's the dangerous thing about diagnoses, is because you diagnose someone, it doesn't matter what they is, everybody else is only going to hear the word crazy. And everything they say after that is discounted. And this is very unfair. And if you're correct, going back through history, that this is a common problem, and that humans get other human spirits attached to them, if this is a common problem, well then, my God, if this is still going on in our day and age, which it must be, then how many problems that people have in our day and age that could be attributed to this, this spirit attachment phenomenon, and many other things that I want to ask you about. I just noticed the clock. We got to take another break here, Nasos.
Okay.
I get so wrapped up in the conversation with you, I forget about looking at the time. So, again, we'll pick it up from here when we come back from the break. Athanasios Komianos is my guest, joining us all the way from Athens, Greece, to talk about this fascinating phenomenon of spirit attachment. Did you know that it went that far back into history? I didn't. We'll be right back. You know, I often think about Jim Morrison as one of the people on this earth with one, he had one foot in this world and one foot in the next world. And you know, we've got Athanasios Komianos on the program tonight, and if I'm really hearing what he's telling us, we might all have one foot in this world and one foot in the next world and not even realize it. These experiences that we call supernatural or preternatural, above the natural, just may very well be absolutely natural phenomenon that we just don't have a scientific explanation for yet. I put yet on there with a capital Y. And welcome back, Nasos. Absolutely engaging conversation tonight. But let me ask you something. Is spirit attachment the same as possession, or are they two different things?
You see, a spirit may attach to you, but not possess you in a sense that it takes possession of your will. Possession is more, it is not as an accurate word, only as in terms of state. In other words, if the attaching spirit takes possession of your will, of your speech, of your body, then it is possession. But many times, there is an interchange of my personality comes up, my identity is dominant, but all of a sudden that identity goes down and the attaching identity comes up. So when it has to do with dominance, which personality is dominating the body at the specific moment? So the more accurate and more correct word should be attachment, because we attach entities. Okay, we do have intruding entities into our bodies. Let's say now I enjoyed that Jim Morrison tune now, and you got me back in the 60s. You know, back then everybody was on drugs. If you remember, everybody was using mind-opening drugs, mm-hmm. LSD mainly, maybe pot as well. But usually those drugs were hallucinatory. Now, some of these experiences are not as hallucinatory as we think of them. Actually, they are mind expanding, and they open the doors of consciousness to the other world. Of course, many people went crazy because of this, but they were trying, experimenting with mushrooms, if you remember, mm-hmm. and they were opening the doors of consciousness. But some of them had travels and experiences that resemble the near-death experience, and they were really enriched by this. So I'm sure that when you expose yourself to drugs, you not only open the doors to consciousness, but you also, because you do it through drugs, you open the doors to attachments. You open the doors for somebody else to walk in. When you walk out of your body and you go for a spiritual journey, somebody else may walk in your body. But I don't know if you understand what I'm talking
about. No, I do. You're making your point here very clearly. But why? Why? What is the purpose of a spirit getting into a human body? Because if I think about it, if I was a spirit, mm-hmm. well, then the whole world is available to me. Space and time no longer mm-hmm. matter. I can travel wherever I want. I'm a spirit. I don't have to eat. I don't have to worry about my body anymore. I mean, this mm-hmm. seems to me the ultimate in existence, being a spirit. So mm-hmm. why would you then want to get back into a human body with all the problems having a human body involves? Why would you want
to
do that?
Okay. You want me to be sincere, don't you?
Yes.
Okay. Because you're a drug addict, you crave for alcohol, you want to have sex, you want to kiss a woman, you want to kiss a man, you know, irrespectively. You know, you crave for addictions that you had when you were alive. A lot of people die all of a sudden. They die prematurely or violently. Those people are not aware of their death. And what happens is that they are usually stuck lingering around in the lower astral and trying to look up for their beer, that they don't have a beer. They are looking after a cigarette or a pot or name it. They want to gamble in Las Vegas or whatever. So you can understand that not all people are thinking like you, Heather. Not all people want to enjoy the spiritual world and go up to the light and see all this enlightened ideas and expose themselves to the spiritual world. No, they're stuck here and they want to have their addiction satisfied again.
Okay.
So what they do, let me go back to ancient Greece again, just for, people should learn these things. They don't know these things. But in Greece, we had four necromancies. Necromancy is a mundium where people who were bereaved and they had lost a relative would go there to communicate with them. Okay, with a relative, because that relative died accidentally or prematurely or with a very violent death. They wouldn't go there if you died in battle. They wouldn't go there if you died when you were old. They would do that only for those violent, sudden deaths. And the reason they did that is because they knew that the spirit never... when they have a sudden death, they cannot go to the proper way. They cannot go to the light. They cannot release themselves to go to the spiritual world. And they are stuck. So they would take their donkey or their mule and go 500 kilometers away to visit the psychomandium there and have a supernatural experience of talking with their dead. That was the reason why they were doing that. And we have many testimonials from that time. But you know what? Modern archaeologists, what are they saying? That the priests were fooling the patients and the visitors with tricks so that they would see supposedly apparitions. But the truth is that they did see apparitions and they had relief from their sour feelings for having lost their child or their spouse or whomever. Let me tell you, another American, you see, you thank God, you have a lot of brilliant people there in America who are doing great job. I'm sure you are aware of Raymond Moody.
Dr. Oh, yes. Moody. Oh, yes. Okay. Absolutely.
Yeah, you know him. And for me, his best book is not Life After Life, what he's very well known for, and he has sold millions of books throughout the world. For me, his best book is Reunions. What he did in Alabama is, after he visited Necromandium here in Greece, he said, I will replicate this. I will try to do exactly what the ancient Greeks did and see if that works. And guess what?
It worked.
It worked. He took an old windmill, watermill over there in Alabama, and he created a psychomantium, and he's seeing people who are bereaving for the death of their loved ones, and he accepts them, and they have a full day session there. You know, he talks with them, he encounters with them, they eat together, and then they go into the psychomantium. More than 50% of these people did see alive 3D the apparition of their beloved one.
Wow. You know, I had a guest on the program. We talk about the afterlife so much on the program. And I had one particular guest on, and she had just mentioned in a comment on the show, oh, yes, I've used the psychomantium before. And anytime somebody says something like that, you know, I want to get in there and expand and learn about what happened. And I asked her, so you went into the psychomantium. What happened? And her demeanor so changed. Oh, no. Oh, no. I can tell you that it worked. Other than that, we are not talking about it. It was incredibly personal. I mean, you could tell that now all of a sudden it's all fun and games when we're talking about the afterlife as it, you know, relates to other people. But then when it was her personal story, no.
She wouldn't share it.
It was, yep. It got a very serious tone all of a sudden. And I thought that is so telling. Because now I don't even need the details. It had such a profound impact on her, and she did communicate with her loved one. I think it was a family member at the time. And it was just the way she responded to the question really struck me. And now I've been fascinated with this idea of the psychomantium ever since. I know it's old. I mean, it comes from antiquity. And why don't we use this more often? Why is it so, it's still looked at as a really weird thing to commune or communicate with your passed on loved ones? I wish it wasn't that way.
Yeah, I wish that it wasn't that way as well, but I strongly suggest Dr. Moody is getting older now. I strongly challenge you to invite him on your show and ask him to talk about this, only this, you know, because we all know the story about near-death experiences and, you know, we all know him for that. But it would be an excellent topic if you invited him over for this.
Yes, I
met him in Prague this year in a congress of transpersonal psychology, and he was fabulous. I mean, he's such a pleasure to listen to and talk to. He gets younger day by day. I don't know his secret yet. Amazing.
Yeah, well, he's a pioneer.
He's a psychiatrist who is, you know, honoring his profession.
Yes,
that's what I have to say. And he was there with Stanislav Grof, also a Czech psychiatrist who was doing, you know, the work with LSD back in the 60s. But that's another story. Now, I want you to understand that since Raymond Moody successfully repeated experimentally this, any serious researcher could really take the challenge and continue with this. Actually, Raymond Moody did that almost 25 years ago. He published on this in 93. So it's 25 years since he published on this. So he has been doing it for 30 years. You can imagine the experience he has on this. I have also managed to replicate it a couple of times in ideal conditions. But the point here is now the spirit attached. And we have to look into how spirits can attach. So if they're thirsty for drugs, they want booze, they want pot, they want sex, they are addicts, they have all the motives to enter into the body. But of course, not all of the attachments are, they want to eat chocolate or cake or spaghetti or whatever. So they crave for it. But they are not only for this reason. Some of the attachments are because something is happening to the person who is undergoing a deep crisis, and they resonate with this person. They come close because they feel sympathetic to this person. And when they come overly too close, it seems as if the magnetic field of the living person is sucking in that lingering spirit, and then it gets into the body and it cannot go out anymore.
Oh my, now that is interesting.
Yes, it is very interesting. Again, we have another case of a person who explained this situation when he had a near-death experience. It was Dr. George Ritchie, a psychiatrist from Virginia. He had a near-death experience back in 1943. And as he was dead and he was lying there in the dorm, in the the morgue. Excuse me for my English, but it's not as good as it used to be.
I think your English is just fine. You're doing just fine tonight.
Okay, thank you very much. So as he was, you know, in the morgue, his soul flew and he ran into a bar. And that's in the first book of Raymond Moody, actually, that story is there. And then he wrote the story himself. It's Return from Tomorrow, it's called, the book. So you can listeners can find it on the internet. He's dead now, but at the time he explained how he flew, and he was in a bar and he would see people drinking their drink and other people sitting behind them trying to drink from the drink that the sailors were having. And all of a sudden sailor has drunk so much that he collapses and he falls down from booze. He's, you know, he's really drunk. And then they open his head and 1, 2, 3, 4 spirits, I don't remember the number now, just jumped into the body and they disappeared from his vision. Now, is that possession or attachment?
I don't. Oh,
it's
wow.
Attached.
Yeah, well, it's almost okay. Like the spirit enters the human body to go on, in essence, you know, a carnival ride. They want to experience being drunk again. You know, for me, if it was me, now that I really have a perspective and an understanding on this, I would be hanging out at the coffee shop all the time.
Watching that. No, you can always drink, but you can protect yourself. You know, you have to make sure that your aura is protected and it's not violated. Mm. You can be violated when you have a traumatic event, let's say an accident.
Mm-hmm.
You have a car accident, okay? And your aura opens immediately because you are in total shock. At that moment, anybody can walk in, especially people who are sympathetic for what is happening to you. Or you can, knock on wood, if a person is raped, their aura is collapsing because they are totally violated by, very violently violated. So there your aura breaks. Anything can walk in from there on.
Oh.
So there are,
you know,
very big moments where things can happen.
Yeah.
Things can enter in.
Well,
I could share a story with you, a case, if you wish.
Oh, sure. Yes, go right
many
ahead.
Many cases, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I had a client a few months ago. He came in to me. He was about 55 years of age, very good professional. He's entrepreneur, but he had panic attacks and crises, and he couldn't control himself, and he was very nervous. And so I started talking to him and taking history, and I realized that he had run into an accident many years ago, a car accident, and a very terrible car accident. He had a premonition for this, and he was as if he was told, don't go there, but he didn't listen to the premonition. We all do that mistake. We never listen to the premonition. So he set out for that travel with all his family, and his mother was sitting next to him, and they were smashed by a truck, and his mother was dismembered by the big truck, but she was still alive, and he's in total shock, and you know, he's trying to get her out of the car to give her help. The ambulance is late, is not coming, and she dies there in front of him, you know, and there she's dead. And guess what? Where do you guess the spirit went?
Into him.
Exactamo.
Rather than into her.
Exactly. It didn't go to the light. It was sudden death. They had only a couple of split seconds in their minds. And there it was, in his body. And she stayed there for years. And she was actually, didn't want to harm him, but she was there, attached to him. And he was not behaving properly. He was not himself. So there I am. I knew that from the interview arrive at that moment. So immediately he is at the scene of the accident, and I knew that that had happened, and I asked her, "Are you here, dear lady?" And the voice changes. Of course, it's not a woman's voice, but you can hear the tone. It's different. She's using the vocal, the vocal cords of her son, but still the voice is different. It's mellower, it's softer, it's different.
Yes, yes.
The manner of speaking is different. And there she starts telling, "Oh my God, I didn't want to hurt him. I didn't know that I did, so I just wanted to show him that I am alive and nothing. He shouldn't cry, he shouldn't worry." "That's okay, dear lady. Let's work it out. That's okay. It is your son. But now you have to go on your own way and let him back." Well, I tell you, this session lasted 18 minutes. 18 minutes by the clock. Everything I record, by the way. They are there for people, you know, to test me if they want.
Mm-hmm.
18 minutes. This man is relieved. His mother goes up to the light. He called me the day before yesterday to tell me how much his life has changed radically. He has discovered his old self again. His wife is finally seeing the guy she married to years ago. And he's so happy. And he just sent me a couple of bottles of wine, you know, as a thank you for what I did for him. So I'm not trying now to promote my business. What I'm trying to tell you is how the process works.
Well, sure. And you didn't use medication. The man didn't have to get tied up. He didn't have to be put in a padded room or committed or any of those things. When you go in as a regression therapist, accepting that there is a soul, accepting that these things happen, and then you access the problem, however strange it might be to some people out there, and look at the results. Again, I'm a results type of a person. So when you see results like that, how can you question? How can you question it? And then, of course, I bet you stay in touch with some clients over time to see how it's going over time.
And follow up.
Yes, exactly. And I'm sure if somebody snaps or has a psychotic break, you would make note of that and do whatever you got to do. But I bet, now we have to take another break here, but I bet that doesn't happen to you, Nassos. Again, we do have to take a break here. And when we come back, of course, there's more to talk about with Athanasios Komianos. But you're all welcome to call up. It's time to open up the phone lines, everybody, and hear from all of you. It'd be so easy to just talk with him straight the whole night through. I could easily do that. But it's your turn. We'll be right back. And it is that time of night. That time of night for you to call in and join the conversation. Nassos is just about one of the most interesting people you'd ever want to talk to. And the subject matter tonight, I mean, with what he just said before the break, now I have so many questions. I mean, we have misunderstood this phenomenon. We truly have. Think about it. If the body, if the living human body is the thing that draws in the spirit, right? The discarnate human that's out there, or whatever is out there. Well, then this is a little bit different than the way we've thought of it before. We've sort of thought of it before as, oh, I have this invading spirit invading my body, and how dare they invade my body? I think it's the other way around. It could be backwards. And welcome back to the program, Nassos. You know, mm-hmm. The last break, not this break, but the one before that, we came back with Jim Morrison and The Doors. And, you know, I can't help but think about his story right now. You know, Jim thought that he was possessed by Indians. He really thought this. He was a young child. He was driving in the desert with his family in the back seat, and they drove past a bad car wreck. It was actually not even a car wreck. It was a truck. There was mm-hmm. a truckload of Indians, probably workers, and they had gotten in a bad wreck on the highway. And Jim was a young boy, and he saw this, and he saw bodies on the ground. He saw people bleeding and crying and everything. And he really thought that at that moment, two, not just one, but two different spirits jumped into his body. And that's why he called himself Chief Mojo Rising, as a nod to that. And if you listen to his lyrics and you read his poetry, you'll see this come out now and then in his poetry. He'll talk about it. And
thank you for sharing this. I had no idea about that.
You didn't know? You didn't
Very
know
interesting.
That?
No, about I had Jim? No idea.
Yeah. I have a song that I play now and then. Maybe I'll play it for you tonight. It's called The Ghost Song. And it's on an album that they did after Jim Morrison passed away. It's called An American Prayer. Right before Jim died, he wrote a book of poetry when he lived in Paris, and it was called An American Prayer, this little book of poetry. So after he died, the band got together, and they wanted to do an album out of this poetry, because Jim would sit and he'd read his poetry and talk his stream of consciousness into a microphone. So they decided, let's put these recordings to some music and we'll make this awesome album, and it's called An American Prayer. The whole thing is really bizarre album, but there's this one song on there, it's called The Ghost Song. And
wow.
It's interesting, you know, when the song is starting, you'll hear like a rattlesnake rattle, and you'll hear these very Native American sounding drums, and he goes through this poetry. Well, he doesn't spell it out. You kind of have to listen to the whole Doors catalog to get these little bits and pieces of this story that he tells. But deeper into the album, An American Prayer, he tells it explicitly. Now, we went past this car accident, and I really believe that these two Indian spirits jumped into my body. Now that you know that, consider this. Jim was just completely wild. I mean, he lived in Los Angeles, and he was too wild for the people in L.A. to the point where when right before he moved to Paris, where he unfortunately he died there, he was a pariah in Los Angeles, in Hollywood. Nobody wanted anything to do with Jim. He was just too crazy. They would wake, you know, the sun would come up and they'd find Jim in a gutter, you know, in front of the whiskey or something like that, and he'd be mumbling. Yep. He'd be just hammered, still wasted, and people didn't want anything to do with him. Now, wouldn't two Indian spirits who had passed away suddenly find themselves in the body of this young man who grows up in Los Angeles and becomes a rock star, wouldn't they just have the greatest time with that? Wouldn't they really live it up? Talk about the fleshly pleasures. My God, Jim Morrison experienced them all. And let me take you back to when he would be seen on stage back in the 60s. He'd do this Indian dance. He would, it'd be in the middle of the show. They'd be doing this bang up incredible show concert, and he would start with, he'd have his microphone and he'd start going around in a circle doing this Indian dance. And if you imagine...
Yeah, you're right. I've seen those.
It all
makes sense now. Yeah,
yeah, if you imagine the headdress and imagine him wearing, you know, a traditional Indian garb outfit, it makes perfect sense that this man was possessed. And I just... Wow. I'm getting chills putting the pieces together here.
Uh-huh.
And
me
I
too.
Thought you would you would enjoy that, because I just couldn't help but tell you that story. It is an amazing thing.
It fits in here. Yeah, absolutely. I had no idea about that. And thank you for telling me this, because I will search for it more.
Yeah, definitely. Go look into
it. I'm collecting these stories, you know. And thank you for sharing that. I didn't know. I had no idea.
His story has always...
Let me tell you something, which will go things even further, because you said that he had deviant behavior and he was really upsetting people all around and he was really aggressive. And I understand, since he was always on booze and drugs. The point is this. Have you ever thought... What makes a person want to change his sex and become a woman if he's a man, or vice versa?
You know, that's in the news.
You really?
Yeah, it's in the news a lot.
Do you really think that, it's a problem of identity disorder? Oh, come on, man.
Yeah.
This is nothing like this. You can imagine what it is, can't you?
Yes, yes. The thought has crossed my mind, although this is a very hot-button issue here in the United States. But it has crossed my mind. Is there something going on? Is the wires crossed somewhere in the soul?
Well, the best evidenced case we have, and I would tell you that it was written in the Journal of Sexual Behavior and was published back in 1977. It was by a sexologist, a great professor, the best professor at the time in America, Dr. Barlow and his colleagues, published the case of a man who wanted to have a sex change operation. Okay. Mm-hmm. And at the time, of course, things were not as advanced as they are today. But still, they had to do hormonic therapy to change the hormonic outcomes of the person. And they had to kill the testosterone and the android male hormones and replace them with female and estrogens and female or hormones. So this person underwent all kinds of psychological tests, and they measured everything they could at the time, so they made sure that the transition would be fine. Mm-hmm. And they finally reached the last, very last moment where he was to be taken into surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they have an appointment, let's say, on Tuesday. He would have to show up, stay overnight at the hospital, and then the next day he would have the operation taking place. So he never shows up. This guy doesn't, who is now feminized, he's womanized in a sense of the hormones, he's not showing up.
Which is odd, because here he's gone through all the trouble, so you'd
for
think,
2 years, yeah. For 2 years, to make the transition, and he doesn't show up. So Dr. Barlow is one day with his colleagues, with friends of his, out for a dinner in a restaurant. And there, a guy comes up, fully man again. Even for 6 months after the case, that could not have happened. He's fully a man. And he says, "Hello, Dr. Barlow. What are you doing here? What's wrong?" He was a waiter. And he says, "What happened to you? Why didn't you come for the surgery?" And he says, "Well, you see, the owner of the restaurant here took me for a deliverance, an exorcising ceremony. And I went there. He convinced me to go there. And he told to Dr. Barlow that 22 spirits were taken out. And one of them was a very strong feminine entity that wanted to make him change the sex. When all of this 22, it was almost a bus, 22 people were taken out. So when these two people were taken out, this guy went in back into normal state, and he's body started recovering, and he started producing his own hormones again, the male hormones. But Barlow was so astonished, but he said there is no way that any person can have such retrieval and go back to normal state. It would take years for a person to go back to that normal state.
Oh.
And he was so shocked by this that he managed to publish this in the Journal of Sexual Behavior. And while this was a peer-reviewed journal, he said all the story about the exorcism and what happened to that man. And because he was Barlow, he was the top of the top at the time, they accepted his paper and they published it. So it is there, you know. anyone can find it.
Well, that in itself is amazing.
That is an amazing case. So we do have, I personally had such a case with a transgender person, which was fascinating. But unfortunately, it was after he had done the operation. So that there was not much I could do after the operation, because that is not a reversible process, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can change your sex, but you cannot go back and change your back to the original. That's
right.
Impossible.
Yeah, that's right.
So, well, it's an irreversible process, and I strongly suggest that is if a person who has a gender dysphoria, if a person there that is listening right now to us and he thinks that he is in the wrong body, please, before you do anything that may cost you your life after that, please, first visit a regression therapist.
Just to be sure. Some people genuinely don't feel right with the gender that they were born with, and I can understand that. I mean, look, being a human is not easy. Sometimes we just don't feel comfortable in our own skin for whatever reason, but rule it out first and be triple sure, you know, before you start going into any irreversible processes.
Exactly, because, you know, if you go to a psychologist, he will tell you, okay, let me see the questionnaire. Yes, you do have gender dysphoria. You have dissociative, you have a state that you need to change. So please follow these steps and go to the medical doctors to do the procedure to change your body. But that's not the case. First, you have to look into it. Maybe, you know, the person had incarnations as a woman for many, many years, and now she all of a sudden finds herself in a male body. Maybe that feels really uncomfortable. But you have to work it out. We have, you know, twins that kill each other in the womb, but the two souls are left there. Okay? And the soul doesn't go to the light, it's still there, and the one wants to be a male and the other one wants to be a female. And the one, you know, is trying to possess the other. Who is the legal owner of that body? Who is the one who is going to win the game after all? So there are a lot of things that people don't think about. So if you have a friend who has gender dysphoria and doesn't feel nice in the body, please, please don't send them to a regression therapist. His life may change and he may be content with his body after the procedure.
And if he isn't, then you know it's a genuine thing. Yes, this
exactly.
person...
And he can go on and change his body.
Yeah. And I'm perfectly fine with somebody who just doesn't feel comfortable in their own skin. There's a little problem, and we need to correct the problem. Okay, but let's make sure we cover all the bases before we do something that you can't reverse. I have so many questions for you now, but let us take a couple of calls while we've got them, and then we'll have time to talk. Hopefully, people will be sending me their questions and their comments and their thoughts, and through the wormhole, I can get those on the air. With Nassos as well. So we'll just jump right here. Now, these callers have been on hold for quite a while, Nassos, so I have no idea if there's anybody actually there. We might get snoring. I don't know. So here we go. On the phone, you are on the air with Athanasios Komianos, but you can call him Nassos. Welcome to the show.
Oh, Captain, my Captain, I truly hope you know who this is.
I do.
And Sir Athanasios Komianos, I am and should kneel to be knighted by you. You are so knowledgeable on everything, and I don't want to take any time because I know there's a ton of callers that want to talk to you tonight.
Actually,
you can pick the channel you want to talk to them about. You know a lot, and I can't talk because you know I'll go on forever.
Steve, actually, let me tell you. I mean, I know you guys out there, some of you are psychics out there. Some of you are visionaries out there, but I don't know how many of you are looking at my phone. Steve, I have two calls, you and one other. That's what I got right now.
Well, I would love to talk as long as you would like. I would have to say that you and I have shared one experience that we both know about, being on the other side of things. I fought my way back, and the Box Project, I don't know if you got my message about building my mirror now to make things even more complicated, but I think I've leveled the playing field finally. You were right in our last conversation. I think it was roughly a week and a half ago.
Yes.
You're right. And the Athanasios is exactly right. I have been stuck in many planes for a while now. I think you know it's the original Stephen you're talking to right now, I would hope.
Yes, this is Steve in Northern California, who constructed the Devil's Toy Box, and you may have ended up in another dimension. We're not entirely sure, but I can tell you one thing, Steve. You know what? This is what I'm talking about when I talk about ongoing stories in the program. This has been ongoing for I don't know how long, Steve, but I can hear it in your voice. I can hear it in your voice. Something has changed, and changed for the better. And my God, I am so happy to hear this tone in your voice tonight. Really.
Well, you know, I was on call hold last night, and I have been at nasty battle with a lot of things that I never expected would show up. I think I've messaged all over the place with you and the MITD crew on Facebook. If you look, you'd have to look at all the messages I've been sending, but I woke up after being on call hold, I think 3 minutes before the earthquake hit last night.
Oh, my.
And so I've been on since then, and ask anyone in the group. I have chatted, talked to so many people, you know, I've talked to both your producer and, you know, everybody else, and said a lot. And like I said, if there's no other callers, I'd love to chat, or I could learn a lot or be saved from a lot or whatever from Athanasios. Hope I got that right again.
Well, how about this? I mean, we've got another here on a first time caller line, which I'm always excited about, but how about this, Steve? How about this? You just went through a rather dramatic and traumatic paranormal experience with the Devil's Toy Box and possibly the Korean elevator game, which I think you did do. Now, do you think that there were spirit attachments on Eve?
Well, Heather, you know it goes much deeper than that, because even in chats I mentioned today, I was talking about the trumpet sounds that I was a part of hearing that I talked to you about long ago. And strangely enough, shortly thereafter, Inside Edition's story tonight was about those trumpets. It showed up right. This is all happening. And what I think has happened, and I think I'm getting a closer view, is that box, it's different than any other. And I want to destroy it as much as you want it destroyed, even though it was meant to be a beautiful gift to you. But I can't destroy it until I truly understand the design, because there are other boxes that have tried to duplicate it. Mm-hmm. And so now we have so many time changes, I don't think it's fixable now.
Okay, hang on. Let me ask you another question.
I cannot follow you. I cannot understand what is that devil toy box. Could you please...
I can explain that. So there's something called a Dybbuk box. The other name for such a device is a devil's toy box. And what it is just a box that's made with the inside of every single surface being a mirror. So the top, the bottom, all four sides, it's all mirrored. And with this device, some people will trap spirits inside of it intentionally, and they'll just hang on to the box, never opening it. Sometimes people deal with haunting in their home this way. This is a very old-fashioned way to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Some people like to construct a devil's toy box because it's rumored in legend that if you construct a device like this, it opens the doorway between the worlds. And you can maybe pull something in or send something from here on through to the other side. And a lot of times people, there's a warning with these kind of things. A lot of people will say, if you ever find a Dybbuk box or a devil's toy box, never open it. Don't move it from its spot, wherever it is. If you find it inside of a wall or in a basement somewhere, just leave it exactly where it is. Some people make these devices simply to play around with the paranormal and see what's going to happen. Steve here did an experiment with the devil's toy box. I guess he made his a little more complex. That part of it I don't quite understand, Nasos. And he did an experiment with this devil's toy box. He took the devil's toy box, and then he went and he performed a game called the Korean elevator game, which is a weird game. You have to hit the buttons in the elevator a certain way, and allegedly this Korean elevator game will, when you finally emerge on the 10th floor of a building, you'll come out of that 10th floor into another dimension, they say the other side. So he was going to take his box with him and then do this elevator experiment and end up on the other side. And there's a little more to it, but here we are. We're going to be late for our break. I'll tell you the rest of it when we come back from the break. And we've got calls rolling in, so this is going to be a lot of fun. Steve, stay right where you are. I'll conclude that when we come back from the break so that everybody understands what we're talking about. And you know what? It's going to be midnight. Who knows what else will happen? And you're welcome to call those numbers and ask my guest a question. You know, he's covered a whole lot of ground for us tonight to get to this point. And, well, you're more than welcome to ask him a question about what he has talked about so far. My guest this evening is Athanasios Komianos, joining us all the way from Athens and sharing, you know, so many years of research with us in just one night of the program. So I'd like to welcome him on back to the show. Welcome back, Nasos.
Nice to be here,
Heather. Yeah, well, it's always nice to spend an evening with you on the program. You've become one of my new favorite guests. So back to the story there. So he decides to go out and do this crazy thing, and he's going to report back to me what happens when he I was talking about the Korean elevator game just as a part of the news one night, and he says, oh, I'm going to take my devil's toy box now, and I'm going to perform the Korean elevator game, and I'll call you and let you know what happens. And I went, oh, my God. Oh, no, this is not good. So I
strongly discourage Stephen to do this. I discourage any of your listeners in the audience that playing with games is opening the doors to possession.
There you go. Yes.
You are not, you know, you have to be really well equipped to allow yourself to engage in such games. It reminds me of the Ouija board, you know, that a lot of people used to. If you want to be possessed, do this, you know, engage with Ouija board or the devil's box. Now I understood what it was. I'm aware of it when you described it. It's absolutely not my cup of tea. I strongly discourage people, and I tell them that there are very many dangers involved.
Well, there are.
I mean, when you do that.
This is advanced, very advanced spell work here. Incredibly advanced. So advanced. Look, I've been studying magic since I was 12 years old, and I would not attempt this.
Yes, are rightly thinking.
He already did it. You know, Nasos, he already has done it, and so it's a little too late. And then he was calling me to report back. And unfortunately, when I would ask him questions, he just wasn't clear. You know, if you couldn't follow that, well, nobody could follow what he was saying when he would report on what he noticed that right away. And being a little experienced in these areas, I said, well, look, I think something has happened to you. I think you're trapped between the world. You're in some in-between place because you haven't, you've combined two different forms of magic here, and that is a very dangerous thing. And so what you've got to do is draw this spell that you have crafted to a close. You've got to draw it to a close. You've got to ground yourself. This is very important because then you can reflect on what happened. You can reflect on all these things to better understand it. And so he did. He took my advice and drew this to a close. You know, when you're
Great.
Crafting spells, this is very dangerous territory because it's almost like inventing new electronics, and you don't know what these electronics do or how they work or any of it, but you get electrocuted, you know.
Yep, absolutely. So, you have to be really cautious.
Very, very cautious. So he's calling us now because he followed my advice, and he drew this to a close, and I can hear it in his voice. He's a little more clear, and he sounds more in this world than he did before. He just seemed distant. I know he was experiencing broken time and things that happen when spells go wrong. And mm-hmm. so that's why I said, God, I can hear it in your voice. You know, something has happened here, and I'm happy. Oh, my God, I am so relieved that he did follow that advice and drew it to a close. And so what I wanted to ask him is if during this whole course of this thing that he was doing, did he feel like maybe there was a spirit that had attached? Because as you said, look, is this not the perfect opening the door to such a thing? And if he had, well, here's an opportunity to ask you for advice if something like that had happened. So I think we're all caught up now. And I've got a phone full of people that want to speak with you, Nasos. So let's bring Steve okay. back. Find out if he has a question, and I guess we'll go from there.
I'm sorry I'm laughing, Heather, and it's out of love. You know, you are both dead on, so right about everything you just said, but I would take hours to explain my history. This didn't start yesterday. This wasn't an experiment. It started at birth for me. I've died 3 times, okay? I knew what I was getting into, but you are correct. I never imagined what I had designed would show me what I have been shown. And I, for the first time, I told you this, talking to you, I got scared. And I was losing the battle severely. I'm in a band. My main song that I love to play is As Above, So Below. That is basically an F you to demons. I tell them, come find me because I'm taking you out. I play it at 3 a.m. a lot. And I truly believe that I am now, I've leveled the playing field, but it's not for myself. We are now approaching things that are way beyond where we ever thought we'd be, but we've already been there. It's Ibid. It repeats itself. You know what I mean? We're in multiple dimensions, multiple timelines, and unfortunately, I haven't completely destroyed the box. The box was destroyed in some of my lost hours, which I've also talked to you about.
Yeah.
And well, I am not going to completely destroy the box until I completely understand my design, because there's now a ton of duplicates and there's so many fragments that I haven't designed.
Okay.
That,
well, look, I have to move on, but I'm glad to hear that you're sounding a little bit better. You're sounding a whole lot better, actually, a whole lot better, coherent and everything, and that puts a smile on my face, but I don't have enough time. Radio is all about the timing, and so we do have to move on. But look, Steve, you know every Friday I do an Open Lines program, and I'll have a little more time on Friday to talk to you if you want, but I would just urge caution. If you're going to study this thing, it almost reminds me of the doctor on board the ship in that movie Alien, when they get the alien and the doctor wants to study it and everybody else wants to kill it. That's what this is reminding me of right now. So just please, Steve, be careful. Be very, very careful. Think very carefully before you go out and do anything. And look, I wish you absolutely the best, man. I do. But we do have to move on here. I'm going to go on over to this line, and you're on the air with Athanasios Komianos, all the way from Athens. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Heather.
You're welcome.
This is Felipe.
Hi, Felipe.
I needed some advice from Mr. Komianos regarding spirit attachments. Basically, sir, a friend of mine passed several years ago, and sometime after he passed, he appeared to me, or at least I feel he appeared to me in spirit, saying that he would be here to care for me, that he would basically be my guardian angel. And for a while, I felt his presence, and then it went away. My question for you, sir, is there a way to get his presence to come back to help me? And if so, would that cause any harm to his spirit?
Hmm.
Very good question. Thank you, Felipe, for submitting this. We do have a lot of reports of visions of the departed ones. Some of them are really lingering around for some time, and they do want to support us and protect us, but they can never act as guardian angels. That's not their task. They are human entities, not angelic entities, to put it in that way. They are of different substance. So humans are not here to protect us. They may have all the best of intentions. Now, most probably, this person either lost his energy eventually, so he couldn't go anymore to the light, so he got stuck somewhere, or he walked in some person, or he had the courage to go to the light. We have no idea. We cannot, but please do not ask him to come back to help you. If he is in the light, if he is there, and if you are ever in danger, there will be a way for you to be protected. Something will come into you. I don't know if it will be your friend or somebody else. You will be protected. But, you know, the living with the living and the dead with the dead. That's my rule of thumb. I know that I've been studying death all my life, and that is an endeavor that I will never stop until I die. But I'm still here. I love life. I love to enjoy into my flesh. I enjoy doing whatever every other person is doing. But on the other hand, I make sure that I respect death and present it as it really is. So you are not crazy because you saw the apparition of your dead person. A lot of people do see these apparitions. They don't share it anymore because they are afraid they are going to be labeled as lunatics. But talk to him as if he were there and alive. And tell him, address him as if he speak loudly and talk to him and tell him, listen, this is not where you are supposed to be. Just go up to your light. Go on with your life in the spirit world. And eventually we will meet again.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, Felipe, does that help?
I just had a quick question regarding what you said, sir. If he's either going to be, as you mentioned, lost or he did go into the light, I mean, there's obviously no way of knowing where he ended up, right?
No, we cannot know right now. It's right. Impossible. What you could do is maybe if you wanted to expose yourself, you could go and visit a regression therapist. And if the issue comes up, then okay, then you deal with it. But in that respect right now, we cannot, I wouldn't rely on the pendulum or such techniques to understand whether he's gone or not. I wouldn't really rely on this. That's another way to do it. You know, use the pendulum and ask questions, closed questions. But I wouldn't trust it, to tell you the truth.
And you did recommend that I should not tell him to come back or help me like that, right?
No. Not only to you, Philip, to all our listeners. Don't try to invite them, because you keep them here. You don't allow them to move on. You know, by asking them to come here, oh, my husband, please come back here. I need you so much. You don't do well. You don't do good. Allow them to go. Allow them to move on.
Allow them their afterlife.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for the call. We'll move on here to the first-time caller line, and you are on the air with Athanasios Komianos. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I had a question for him.
Sure.
I was wondering if when I was younger, I was less around the age of 4, and by quite a few people up until the age of 10. During that time, around age 4, I had a really bad nightmare that basically something was telling me to hurt my family. I've never hurt anybody, but I still have these recurring thoughts. Is it possible that something had entered me? And I mean, I fight it every day to try to be, you know, a good person, but I feel this evil inside me all the time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing this. Yes, you brought up a very interesting issue, because you see, not only human entities linger around in the spirit realms around us, there are other entities that are not so good. Actually, they are evil, as you mentioned. You could say that they are demonic in nature. There are some spells and casts and, you know, thought forms that are designed to create a bad luck for us. And, of course, black magic, thought forms that are attacking us. Now, in this specific case, I think you had what we call demonic infestation. In other words, you were attacked by the dark side, the evil side, which unfortunately exists, and I'm not a medieval person, I tell you, I've seen this in practice. So, which are the most vulnerable persons? They are the youngsters, the kids, the infants. Mm-hmm. They're very vulnerable. That's why they constantly attack those, and they are trying to violate the aura and break down the defense system that each and every one of us has and enter into there. And what they are doing is trying to implant negative thoughts, evil thoughts, destructive thoughts. An excellent account was given to us very back in the 70s by Arthur Githam. He was a psychiatrist in Bath, England, and he wrote a book called The Psychic Dimension of Mental Health.
Oh.
And in that book, he explained all these night terrors that kids have and all the attacks by the dark side. It was a very sincere book and a very nice attempt to show how these forces operate during the night. So, my dear friend, yes, you may have been attacked, but the problem is also that you are not only infestated by the attacks, probably you are also cohabiting with such a spirit, because it still keeps on telling you to do bad things. A nice trick to always overrun this is to ask yourself, who is talking now? Is it me, or is it the other guy from the darkness who is talking? Immediately the thought will go away. That's a very smart trick. Please practice it daily.
Mm.
Whenever a negative thought comes into your mind, ask yourself, who is talking now? Who is making the talk? Is it myself or is it another entity? Once you do that, it immediately disappears. It hides itself. It loses the battle.
Oh. Now that is very interesting. I imagine that there is a why and a how behind that. But you know what? At this moment, I don't know that I'm concerned with the why and the how as long as it works.
Yep.
You know, again, I pick up a lot from the tone of a person's voice, and I hear it in this man's voice, in this young man's voice, that he's going through a genuine problem right now. And none of
He's not alone. He's not alone. You know how many hundreds of people I've personally worked with which had exactly the same problem here in Greece? I'm not talking, you know, it's a universal problem. A lot of kids are attacked. That's why we have those strong nightmares and the so-called night terrors or enuresis. You know, enuresis when people pee in their bed at night, youngsters, because of fear. They cannot resist that fear and goes away. If you ask these kids sincerely, they are under terror attack from entities which are usually grotesque and very ugly and very evil. And once they are in fear, they collapse, their defense system goes down, and then they are losing the game.
You know, all of this is so closely tied with human emotion. The more I learn, the more I realize this is also closely tied with our emotions. And it's not that we have to be, you know, paranoid and so careful about the emotions that we experience, but we should be aware that that is an energy source and be mindful of that. I want to talk with you about that a little bit more, but again, I don't want to keep the callers waiting. Thank you very, very much for the call, young man, and I would strongly suggest that you follow the advice of Nassos on that. Now, back here to the phone we'll go, and you are on the air with Athanasios Komianos. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. It's Lasha phoning in from Vancouver, where there has been an earthquake, but there has been no wave.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Oh, my God. I about had a heart attack last night.
Oh, I did, too. I was really on edge because I live right near the beach. And it was really hairy for a little bit.
Yeah,
and the news was quite scary.
Yeah, I bet it was. Well, you know, thank goodness nothing happened.
We're all dry, still here. Fine.
Good. I'll take a breath of relief, sigh of relief.
Yeah, me too. That's for sure. I'm very interested in your guest and what he said about spirits being housed in different places. For reasons I can't go into, but I remember a lot of my past lives. And I remember several past lives where you would go and the mystic would be there. They would come to the grave with you, and there'd be a statue next to the grave, and they would conjure the being that had died, the person, your relative, and you could speak to them briefly. I also remember times in ancient times where a lot of these statues, it was done with the breath. You would breathe into the statue, and it would come to life with a certain essence. And this is a kind of a mystical practice that is very, very ancient. And a lot of statues that were like, you know, big statues of Jupiter that they know, and they would have these priests all around them that would be animating these statues, and you would see the images living within the statue. And I'm wondering, when he said, first of all, I'd like to know a little bit more that he knows about that, but also when he said that some of these practitioners would trick people, I kind of wanted to know what he meant by that.
All right.
Sorry if I've gone over too much stuff, but
no, not at all, not at all. It's perfectly fine. I mean, that's what we're here to do, is talk on a talk show, so it's fine. But we do have a break coming up, so I think, Nasos, you're probably going to start to answer a very intelligent and detailed and very thorough answer, and then I'm going to have to come in 20 seconds and cut you off, so I don't want to do that. Maybe can we get your answer for Lasha when we come back from the break? Can be okay?
I
don't like that, because I'm always looking at the clock, and I'm, you know, seeing ahead into the future, and I don't want to do that to you.
A dictator. The time dictator.
Yeah, I know. We are slaves to it. Well, all right then. We've got something interesting when we come back. And I really want to talk to Nasos a little more about what he was talking about before, about evil. Because I do believe that evil does exist, and I want to talk about what we do. There must be something all of us can do to prevent this kind of thing from happening, or at least recognize when it's about to happen. We'll be right back, everybody. I can't pass it up. I love that song. All right. Well, we're in the middle of taking your calls right now with my guest this evening, Athanasios Komianos, and we're talking about the phenomenon of spirit attachments. And, you know, I was really hoping, Nasos, that our caller, Lasha, would stay on the line, but I guess she wants to take her answer off the air. Which one of her questions would you like to tackle first? The statues coming to life, or the priests of old tricking their parishioners?
Well, of course, there is that phenomenon of spontaneous life recollection, past life recollection, okay? Some people do tune into the recollection of past lives. Now, probably she misunderstood what I said a while ago, because I said that the modern archaeologists are assuming that all the priests of ancient Greek religion were fooling people into believing that they communicate with the dead. That's the official story, okay? But that is not the case. I disagree, strongly disagree with that, and I believe that, and of course Raymond Moody strongly disagrees with that, that it was not the priests that were fooling the people into talking. Now, she's talking about an experience she has as a past life, in a past life, with the statues, that they had the ability to animate or speak through the statue. The only historical validation we could have for this is that indeed the first Christian fathers, and you can find those, they exorcised the statues of the ancient Greek and Roman statues. They went there and they were reading prayers out to these statues so that the spirit would walk out of the statue and go to hell. And we have a lot of such testimonials from that time, but it is through the Christians we have such testimonials. But as far as if that was happening or not, I have no idea. There is no way to test that.
Well, there is this phenomenon nowadays with haunted objects, and so spirits seem to attach to objects as well. And if you're a confused spirit on the other side and you see a statue, I mean, those Greek statues are very lifelike. One might get confused. Is that a real body or is that a statue? I don't know. We'll try it out. And it doesn't work, or they don't get the same sensations that they would, obviously, in a statue that they would in a living body. But it is interesting. I would probably pass out if I ever saw a statue come to life.
Talking to you.
Oh, man. I don't even know.
I would certainly do that.
Yeah.
I think there is a statue of Jim Morrison in Paris. So if he started singing, you know, his Indian songs, I would certainly pass out, or I would think I'm dead.
Yeah, the both of us would pass out when we saw that. Oh my gosh! But you know, all of this talk has got me to wondering. You know, how many people experience this? I was just watching a show because I like kind of, I guess you could call it kind of garbage TV once in a while. There's a show called Hoarders, and I am a meticulous housekeeper, so Hoarders, to me, is an absolute horror show. It's a car wreck. I'm fascinated with it. I can't look away. Well, there was an episode that I saw last night where the girl was absolutely convinced that her house was messy because of demons. And she was so convinced. She did everything she could find in every book. She went to priests. She looked things up online and was desperately trying to clear her house of the demons, which she thought was the source of the problem. This is why her house was hoarded, and this is why they had so many problems in their life, was the demons. Well, nothing she did would work. Mm-hmm. According to her, she was even going so far as to cut herself, get some blood, and write Yeshua on her front door in her own blood. I mean, this girl was serious. So what can we do, Nasos, if we think this is happening to us? Is there a way to prevent it, or is it something that can only be dealt with once it happens?
Now, let's not forget that that was a movie, okay? It's not a real story.
Actually, it is a real story.
It's a fantastic story. But it sounds to me, the way you describe it, that here we do have a case that would be labeled as schizophrenic. In other words, it is a permanent thought that is coming into mind, and it's suggesting that everything is happening to her because of demonic influence. But in that case, now, because it's a fantastic, I don't want to consider it, but the acting out of it sounds more towards schizophrenia than to spiritual possession, but demonic possession. And let me explain the difference here. The schizophrenic mind, the psychotic mind, never stops. You know, it's 24/7. And it always is changing thoughts, and it's always flying from one matter to the next, and it never stops. That doesn't happen with the demonic possession. The person is totally normal. And when the demon manifests itself, that person falls into trance, let's say. That personality goes to sleep, and the demon comes up. And it may last for 1 minute, it may last for 10 minutes, it may last for half an hour or 2 hours, and then it fades out again. You don't have that lapse in psychosis. So a person who is experienced with those states can clearly see the difference of mm-hmm. what is one thing and what is the other, if that helps your to understand what I'm saying.
Oh, it does. It does. So true possession is when the person comes back out of it and you say, what just happened there? And they say, what? I don't know. Did something just happen?
Yeah.
They don't remember.
Yeah. They don't remember. They have no access to this. It's as if there is a different memory truck, a different box where things are put in. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you heard of MPD, you know, multiple personality disorder, or DID now, they call it dissociative identity disorder. So we have many personalities expressing themselves in the same body. And when that one personality comes up, let's say they have myopia, and when the other personality comes up, they have the opposite, presbyopia or diplopia. Or in the one case, we have left-handed personality and the other one is right-handed. And the one is liberal and the other one is conservative. We have many cases where in the multiple personality disorder could and might be confused what regular psychotherapists call multiple personality disorder could be attributed easily to spirit attachments. And if you release those spirits and let them go, then you let the original owner of the body express himself again and become, you know, the rightful owner of the body again. So we do have phenomena of dissociation, of disintegration of the personality from the 19th century and on. You know, a hysterical paralysis of one hand, and that is belonging to one of the personalities. But when you treat that personality, the symptoms dissipate and don't exist anymore. So I hope I'm answering your topic.
Well,
and I didn't touch the topic of the space and places. Of course, because indeed, some spirits reside in spaces and haunt them, and they change the energy there. And we have ample of evidence to this direction. So it's not only the body that they reside, it is also the... But, you know, in modern culture, in older traditional cultures, we all speak about haunted houses and ghosts. That is acceptable. What is preposterous and unacceptable and really bizarre is being possessed by spirits, is being attached, being attached by the spirits, being touched by them, and then they reside in your body. That is an unusual thought. In our culture, in Western societies.
Yes.
But, you know, in other societies, it's not so unusual. There is an excellent documentary by BBC, a very good production back in the 2005, I think it was. It's called Psychic Vietnam. If you ever find it, Heather, just see it.
Okay.
It's fascinating story about a lady who had a near-death experience. And after she came back, she could see the spirits of the dead talking to her. And she had the ability to locate the lost people in war. You know, there were a lot of people in war in Vietnam. A lot of Viet Cong soldiers were lost in battle. And more than 400,000 of them were never found. Their bodies were never found. And these spirits were demanding for their bodies to be found and brought back and be buried and have all the proper rituals for them.
Mm-hmm.
And she managed to locate hundreds of these bodies in the exact locations the spirits said in the jungles.
Well, that's incredible.
Now, how can you account for this? I mean, just look for it. You will find it somewhere.
I will. I will go look.
Psychic
for that.
Vietnam.
Wow. That sounds fascinating. I mean, to me, it's weird, but that's how you make the world a better place. One soul at a time, Nassos.
Mm-hmm. And one very interesting issue, if we don't have a caller coming in right now.
No, go ahead.
Is that, you know, the organ donation. You know, people donate their liver, let's say, or their heart. But have you ever thought of this? Do you know of the case of Claire Sylvia, the lady who had a simultaneous lung and heart transplant back in the 80s? Are you aware of her story?
I don't know if I'm aware of her story, but I do know about the phenomenon you're talking about. I have my own personal experience with it just a little bit. It wasn't an organ, but it was a blood transfusion. And fascinated.
Yeah, it happened there as well.
Yeah, I'm fascinated with this phenomenon. A person gets a heart from an athlete, and all of a sudden they want to go run and play sports when they heal up. There's a part of the personality that's transferred because of the transplant, and I've been fascinated with this for a long time.
So what happens is part of the consciousness of the dead person is actually following the parts that have been transplanted to the new body, and these persons behave differently. I had a case of my own in my family when this guy was the first Greek to ever be to ever have a new liver to be transplanted, and the operation took place in Paris, because at that time here in Greece they wouldn't do that, in 94. And he was a priest. That guy was a priest, a Greek Orthodox priest. And when he was into the operating room, a guy came in and he said, "Give me my liver back." He demanded his liver.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And he had a fight with him. They had a fight, a talk. You know, he was demanding his liver back. So the priest started talking to him. We are talking now in the spirit world. And he started talking to him, and he started to make him quiet. And then when he woke up, he said that he saw this experience, and all the doctors dismissed him as a lunatic, and they said this is not happening. So you know that the rules are very strict, and you are not allowed to know who your donor is.
That's right.
But he was very influential. He was very influential, and he finally discovered that this guy was a Spaniard who was killed in an accident between the borders of France and Spain, and his liver was compatible with himself, and he demanded for the picture, and he found the picture, and when he found the picture, it was exactly the person he saw in his vision, and he had a fight with him.
Oh my God!
It was amazing, because when he was sharing his story with our family, we all were all shocked listening to what he was saying. And then I discovered the work of Dr. Schwartz, and that you have invited in your show.
Yes, yes, Dr. Gary Schwartz. Yes, he writes about this.
And also of Dr. Pearsall, who is not with us anymore. He died years ago. But they, you know, they published 10 cases. Very fascinating. So actually, guys, if you want to donate your organs, you have to really bless them, and make sure you detach from them when you die. I mean, make sure that you don't follow up your liver or your heart or your kidney. Just allow yourself, I mean, do it before you die.
Yes.
Bless your organs and say, in case I die prematurely and somebody might be saved from my organs, make sure that they're blessed and with light, and that you give them with all wholeheartedly to your possible donors.
Mm.
Not donors, possible
recipients.
Recipients, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I guess I got lucky, because I was not much of a cook before I had to have a certain surgery that I had to have. And afterwards, man, I can cook like you would not believe. I must have, I seem to think that after the blood transfusion, I must have gotten somewhere in there. Now, they had to give me a lot of blood to save my life. But I think somewhere in there was an Italian chef, because, man, can I ever make Italian food? Oh, gosh. And I get into it, too, and I get excited about ingredients. I'll go in the store. They probably think I'm out of my mind. Oh, look at this fresh basil. This is going to make such a good margarita pizza. I don't even know. I didn't know what a margarita pizza was beforehand. And now, apparently, I do. And I can make you a really good one, too. That I kind of laugh at it, but I think I got lucky. It could have been a lot worse. What if all the people who donated their blood to me came and wanted to, you know, ask me, they wanted to ask me, well, what do you have to say for yourself? You're taking my blood away, my very lifeblood. But,
but,
you know
Italian people are very possessive. You know, they are very territorial.
Oh, no.
this guy was saying, oh, why are you giving this blood to her? And he followed his blood. No, I strongly advise you, Heather, to visit a regression therapist and have a session.
Am I going to lose my cooking ability? I mean, I really have gotten attached.
Yeah.
I've gotten attached to it. I kind of like it. And there had to have been a Mexican chef in there, too, because I really can cook some Mexican food. Oh, man. But I'm really serious. Before all of that, you know, I would cook American food and not very good. I mean, I would burn a grilled cheese sandwich. It was not that great. I ate out most of the time. And now I just feel so lucky. Not only was my life saved, but I can cook now. This is great. This is really great. But, you know, I want to end on a specific note, if you don't mind, Nassos, because here we've been talking about so many things tonight. How do people prevent this from happening to themselves, or how can they protect themselves from a possible possession or an attachment or something like that? Is there anything we can do to either recognize that this is going on or prevent it?
That's a long story, but to be brief, first of all, do not engage yourself with addictive behaviors. Addictive behaviors attract lingering spirits who were addicted when they were in body.
Mm.
Okay? So then, don't engage in games that have to do with Ouija boards, with the devil's box, with things that might invite discarnate spirits. You know, not benevolent spirits are living in the lower astral place. Mm-hmm. They are only malevolent. So please make sure, don't attract them, don't invite them, don't channel them. It's better to channel yourself, not to channel other spirits. You think they are benevolent and that they may bring in wisdom to you, but that's not necessarily the truth. Mm. We are actually opening up the space for them to come. The next thing you have to do is build up a psychic defense. In other words, you have to create with your imagination and enhance it daily. A protective shield that extends over and out of your body. Let's say to the extent that when you open your hands, and imagine that you are the yolk of the egg, that your body is in the center of the egg and that egg is surrounding your body all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So by being surrounded by this protective full of light shield, none of these infiltrating energies can harm you, even if you have a very distressful situation. So I would do that imaginary exercise daily to make it strong. And each time I would imagine that I am in that shield and I'm fully protected and I resonate with the powers of creation and of powers of creativity and the powers of love and the powers of light and of order and of happiness and of harmony and equilibrium.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would not invite the powers of chaos, of anarchy, of disorder, of darkness, of negativity. I know that there is darkness and that darkness is the other side of light, but please stay on that side. Try. We all have darkness. Everyone has darkness. It's always there. It never goes away. But try to keep it. A guy, an Indian, a young one, is seeing two wolves. The one is a white, nice wolf, and the other one is a black, ugly wolf.
Yes, yes.
And he goes to the shaman, he's a leader of the tribe, and he asks him, I see those two. Who is going to prevail? And what does the old shaman told him?
The one you feed.
Exactly. So please feed the white wolf in you.
I'd say it couldn't have been better said, Nasos, and that is a perfect note to leave everybody with after the conversation we've had tonight, because people are probably now looking around their rooms in a little bit of a different way than they were before the show started.
They should.
And, yeah, these are good. You know, his techniques here are very simple, which is good. I'm always appreciative of that. And they make sense. They make sense and they feel right. And I would only, if there was anything to add, just observe your personality. Any personality changes, then that ought to catch your attention. Nasos, what about your website? Let's get your website out there before we have to go.
Yeah, my website is probably on your it's hypnoscopesis. It's a very long word, hypnoscopesis. It's a term, .gr, www.hypnoscopesis.gr. Mm-hmm. Or if you write my name, Athanasios Komianos or Nasios Komianos, you will find me on the internet, and you can Google me. Mm-hmm. You can find my YouTube channel. You can Google me and talk to me. And if you have more questions, visit your local regression therapist in your country, in your county, in your town, if there is one.
Yes,
they
absolutely.
Will help you. They're trained and qualified for this. And they have this ability to do.
And it's going to be a little bit of a different kind of a treatment than you would get with traditional psychology. And the book that we've been talking about all night tonight is Rapid Entity Attachment Release by Athanasios Komianos. Now, one of my absolute favorite guests, and I will leave all of you with that. Catch you here tomorrow night, where we'll go on another ride. And, well, everybody, just think about that white wolf. And good night.
Are we heeding all the signs? Have we lost our intuition? Are we running out of time?